Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
DemocracyNow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, and we are on the road in Chicago. I'll be at noon in San Francisco on Saturday, speaking at Greenfest, and Sunday, 1:30, with Noam Chomsky and University of Michigan Professor Juan Cole in Princeton at the Nassau Presbyterian Church. But right now, we're in Chicago, and as the most expensive presidential election in U.S. history has come to an end, we turn to an issue that impacts more and more people in this country, but was rarely mentioned during the campaign. Poverty. The price tag for combined spending by federal candidates, along with their parties and outside groups like super PACs, totaled more than $6 billion. This is especially striking at a time when one in six Americans is poor, with over 16 million children living in poverty. Poverty rates for blacks and Latinos are twice as high as the rates for whites. There is greater poverty among women than men, and the rate of women living in extreme poverty has reached record highs. But a study released by the media watchdog group FAIR, that's Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, they revealed that poverty as an issue has been nearly invisible in U.S. media coverage of the 2012 presidential race. It found just 17 of the 10,489 campaign stories studied, that's 0.2%, address poverty in any substantive way. Critics have pointed out that President Obama was viewed as the anti-poverty candidate in 2008, but his reelection bid 4 years later has barely mentioned the poor, even though their numbers have gone up. Well, for more, we're joined by two guests who've worked diligently to get poverty back on the national agenda. Dr. Cornel West is with us, professor of philosophy and Christian practice at Union Theological Seminary in New York and professor emeritus at Princeton University. He's a New York Times bestselling author of numerous books and co-host of the radio show Smiley and Tavis, Smiley and West with Tavis Smiley. Together, they've written the new book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. Tavis Smiley is a TV, radio, broadcaster, philanthropist, New York Times bestselling author. He hosts the PBS show Tavis Smiley and two radio shows, The Tavis Smiley Show on NPR and Smiley and West with Cornel West. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now!
Good to see you, Amy.
It's good to be with you. So we're right here in the president's city. In fact, he just flew out on Wednesday after his reelection. Cornel West, the figures. Who is ahead? Who isn't? As your book and is titled, The Rich and the Rest of Us.
Well, one, I think that it's morally obscene and spiritually profane to spend $6 billion on elections. $2 billion on a presidential election and not have any serious discussion. Poverty, trade unions being pushed against the wall, dealing with stagnating and declining wages when profits are still up and the 1% are doing very well. No talk about drones dropping bombs on innocent people. So we end up with such a narrow, truncated political discourse as the major problems, ecological catastrophe, climate change, global warming. So it's very sad. I mean, I'm glad there was not a right-wing takeover. But we end up with a Republican, a Rockefeller Republican in blackface with Barack Obama. So that our struggle in regard to poverty intensifies.
That's a pretty rough assessment of President Obama.
Oh, that's what we have. That's what we have. Richard Nixon is to the left of him on health care. Richard Nixon's to the left of him on guaranteed income. And the same policies in terms of imperial foreign policy is at work. And so I was glad to see that Romney didn't win. We pushed back a right-wing takeover. We've got a right-wing mentality, cut, 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 austerity, austerity, austerity. Where is the serious talk about investment and jobs, fighting the privatizing of education, and the empowerment of trade unions? And so our battle is just beginning. We have yet to take off the gloves. Yeah, we've been fighting intensely.
President Obama said to Harry Belafonte, according to Harry, why don't you and Cornel West cut me some slack? And Cornel and Harry Belafonte responded, what makes you think we're not?
That's exactly right.
Damn you, Obama.
So a non-white person, they say, well, you know, President Obama, he is clearly a non-white person. There is a white person who is working at Wendy's, making minimum wage, struggling. You are not going to tell me that President Obama is inferior to that white person, that President Obama is less than that white person working at Wendy's. What would you say to that?
I would say he's still under the system of white supremacy, and is the white supremacist, according to Mr. Obama himself. He wouldn't have that job.
You're saying if it was not for the white people who practice racism, white supremacy, Mr. President Obama would not be in the White House?
If any black person who forgets that is forgetting a very important fundamental, he couldn't even been running. His name would have not been known. He wouldn't have had a white mother in Kansas who could teach him anything if the white supremacists had not agreed to that. See, I'm talking about white supremacy, thinking about it in depth, not just on the surface. A lot of black people just think he just walked in there and say, hey, I'm a president. I'm going to be president. And I'm going to be president because I want to be president, and it don't make no difference what you white people think. He didn't walk in there like that. When he was campaigning, he said, I'm asking you all to help me. And white people came out in Springfield, Illinois, by the thousands, and took a look at him. And said, you know what? I think I give this boy a chance. You know, to go through the training that we have given him, you know. Yeah, because, you know, and like Mr. Obama himself said, you know, in 4 years you can snatch me out of here anyway. They can snatch him out of there before 4 years.
Mm.
Yeah, they can. He can give up that seat tomorrow if the white people decide, hey, that's right. He'll walk right in there, right in the middle of all them papers that are stacked up on his desk. And he's trying to solve problems and all like that. And they walk right in there and they tell him, hey, just like the mafioso, the organized crime, which is what white supremacy is, they just walk in and say, hey, you know, we made a decision this morning. You're out of here. We got a janitor's job for you at Union Station. And that's where he will be. He came to work at 9, at 10. He's down there putting on his janitor's cap and drawing his equipment out of the storage room for buffing floors. First black president. Photograph of it. You know how Mr. Obama looks.
Yes, sir.
He can look the same way, smiling, behind a broom. In Union Station in Springfield, Illinois, or whatever the train station is there. Say, how did you go from president to here? White people decided it. Say, well, what do the black people think about that? Well, who cares? They better try to hold on to that janitor's job they got, if they got one.
Context of white supremacy. Justice Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, November 30th, 2012, so I have been told. We will be back on Saturday. Actually, we'll be, should be, white people permitting. We should be broadcasting every day for a while. We should be back tomorrow with the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Looking forward to hearing the exchange of views, catching up on what has been happening on the plantation. Anyone, if you're having, if you've had workplace successes or problems, definitely you can dial in to share that. You have new terms, new definitions, strategies for neutralizing racist man, racist woman, racist child. Definitely tune in Saturday evening. This Sunday, Mr. Aaron Berg, host of Reality Unknown, he had Gust on as a guest a couple times. The white people, I can't even say suspects, in my opinion, the racists at TalkShoe, they deleted my account as well as Mr. Berg's account simultaneously towards the end of the summer. I think not just on the same day, but I mean at the exact same moment, they deleted both of our accounts. Probably some other non-white people who had accounts talking about racism, white supremacy. He'll be a guest with us this Sunday to talk about his experience in terms of what can happen when you decide that you're going to start speaking about racism, white supremacy. This Sunday evening, 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Central, and 3 p.m. Pacific, Mr. Aaron Berg. And then on Monday, he's been with us a couple times, Mr. Joseph Gibson. He was with us earlier this year to discuss his book, Trapped in Rainbows. We also had him back during the middle of the summer, I think. He was talking about his book on religion. Really interesting concept on how racism, white supremacy came about. And the symbolism behind all of that, things black people were doing, maybe some incorrect things that black people were doing that resulted in the rise of white supremacy. We talked about that this summer. This Monday evening, we will be talking about one of his other books, prolific author, one of his other books, God of the Addicted. I think we have repeatedly discussed the problems that non-white people face as a result of Christianity and trying to combat what white people have been, are doing to us, and how Christianity and those white images of God and their racist religious concepts really get in the way of us having the correct counter-racist thinking to neutralize racism, white supremacy. God of the Addicted, we'll be discussing that Monday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. So we should be very active. I was hoping, planning to do the broadcast this past Wednesday on my summer vacation, but just did not have the vitality to get it done this Wednesday. As I said, I'd been having a lot of issues sleeping, so I took some time just to rejuvenate, replenish, got some rest. I'm feeling a lot better, a bit more rested, and we'll hopefully get that knocked out this coming Wednesday. Should be constructive. As I said, my vacation this summer ended up being very focused on racism. I even remembered some of the anecdotes that people were sharing. I had my counter-racist t-shirt on, please respect me like I am a white person, had my counter-racist t-shirt on, and it prompted a lot of I think constructive dialogue on racism, white supremacy. Even had a black teacher tell me about a really interesting anecdote with one of his black students here in Seattle that I had kind of forgotten about, but I was just going over a lot of those details from the vacation to share on the program. So we will get that done this coming week, rain or shine, we will get that done. Anywho, this is our last study session on President Barack Obama's Dreams from My Father. Has been an interesting read, I think. I hope it has been a constructive investment of your time and energy for people who have tuned in. Again, I would highly encourage non-white people to read this book. It seems that many white people have read the book and are thrilled about it. As we have seen, it talks a great deal about racism, white supremacy. In my opinion, it reveals quite a bit of truth about racism, white supremacy. You would probably be better served to get the actual text as opposed to the highly redacted audiobook. But that said, I hope it has been constructive. I'll be looking forward to kind of wrapping things up today and hearing from folks who have been listening into the sessions. What are your final views on the book? Has this changed the way that you think about President Obama? I'm sure for some people, they would be thinking, they probably thought at the beginning, they had some questions about whether or not President Obama was the author of this book. If racist man, racist woman, if they put this book together as a part of their racist strategy for having him in the office, we can chat about all of that today, since this will be our concluding session on the book. Again, it looks like, just tallying the votes, looks like 1984 has been the winner. In terms of people emailing in to vote, I guess if you have other choices, there are other books that you would like to do next, you can shoot me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. But it looks like pretty handily 1984 is going to be the next book, audiobook that we can begin next Friday. I will say, man, I just got Melba Patillo Beals. She is a black female. She is one of the so-called Little Rock Nine, when they were the first black students allowed to attend Central High School in Arkansas, 1957. She has an autobiography. It's titled Warriors Don't Cry. And I just got my hands on the unabridged audiobook. Ooh, man, oh man, I wish I had known about that a little earlier. If I had known about it and got my hands on it earlier, I probably would have picked that book, hands down. That would have been the next book we would have done. I started listening to the first disc on Wednesday while I was kind of taking some me time, and wow, this is one of those books. I think some people have asked, some parents, attempted parents have asked about material for younger children that would be good in terms of inspiring them to read, and maybe even has some constructive information about racism, white supremacy. I would put this one pretty high up the list. Now, I haven't read the whole thing yet, but just from what I have heard thus far, wow. But we will get to that down the road. White people permitting, we can make that the book to follow, 1984, George Orwell. At any rate, getting to it, the audio clips you heard at the beginning, Democracy Now with racist suspect, refined white supremacist suspect, Amy Goodman. Those white women, I tell you, they are extraordinarily dangerous. That was from November 9, when she had Tavis Smiley and Dr. Cornel West as guests on their program. As I said, to me, that broadcast stands out for so many reasons. If you continue to listen, they continue to gripe and bash President Obama. You can hear with the white woman chuckling in the background, ha, 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 little anecdotes from Harry Belafonte talking bad about President Obama as well, or scrutinizing, you know, his efforts. And they go on to offer complaints about other non-white people, victims of racism, Melissa Harris Perry, Al Sharpton, Michael Eric Dyson. It's really bad. And they have praise to heap on Abraham Lincoln. It's just, it's very difficult to listen to. And they did an overtime session where they got an additional 15 minutes to continue to talk bad about the victim of racism, President Barack Obama. Again, that is from Democracy Now, November 9. The second audio clip, Neely Fuller Jr., his very first visit to the cows in May 16th, 2009. Very interesting segment. Mr. Fuller has actually addressed President Obama and how non-white people have been responding to him on many different programs, and just saying that he knew there was going to be a lot of that, non-white people attacking him, criticizing him, and saying, you're not looking out for black people, you're not looking out for poor people, you're not doing this, you're not doing that. He said he knew as soon as it was announced that President Obama was going to be running, that there was going to be a lot of that. That is a tendency of non-white people to complain and focus a lot of our frustrations on other victims of racism. And I suspect that there will be a spike in that sort of behavior as President Obama's second term continues. We could chat about all that down the road. At any rate, I will give out the number really quick before we get to the first audio clip. The number to dial is 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943-pound. 760-569-7676. And the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Before we get to the first audio segment, thanks to Mr. Scotty Reed, helped us out. We had a little bit of a tech issue before we got rolling, but he knocked that out in a matter of seconds so we could get rolling. Thank you again, Scotty Reed, founder of the Black Talk Radio Network. And Gus wants to give out a special recognition to one of our consistent listeners. She's been tuning in for long time now, calling in with great observations. B Moore last week on the program. As I said, I feel self-conscious at times because, and I view it as anti-blackness. That's really all I can categorize it. Seems like a significant chunk of non-white people who do tune in to the cows. They are upset with President Obama, it seems, for a variety of reasons. And it seems some of these folks, have the opinion that President Obama did not write this book. A white person wrote it, or whomever wrote it, the rumors and what have you. And I mean, that might be true. I don't know. Most of the people who have made this allegation, they don't have, you know, hard evidence. It's just things that they saw from that documentary film, Dreams from My Real Father, or other news clips online, or things that, you know, someone else has said. And I really appreciated B. Moore last week. Just, white people do this all the time. I mean, it's so, I can't even pick that up. Even if I thought, okay, he didn't write this, somebody else wrote this book. Even if I thought that, white people do that all the time. Everything that black people do, they just swoop in and take the credit for it. I mean, Elvis Presley, Eminem, it just hurts my head. Some of the stuff that they toss out, I mean, it's just standard. It's worse than standard. It's just stale, trifling behavior. They always do that. And I was so pleased that she made an effort to point that out last week. That's all they do. I mean, black people come along and make something, and then 5 seconds later, just any random white person will go, oh, these niggas didn't do that. I did that. I wrote that. I built that. That standard procedure, stale, racist operating procedure. Just wanted to thank her for getting that in. We will move forward. Last study session on Dreams from My Father, President Barack Obama, section number 1.
We followed Yusuf and Saeed down a path running perpendicular to the main road until we crossed a wall of tall hedges and entered a large compound. In the middle of the compound was a low rectangular house with a corrugated iron roof and concrete walls that had crumbled on one side, leaving their brown mud base exposed. Bougainvillea, red, pink, and yellow with flowers, spread along one side in the direction of a large concrete water tank, and across the packed earth was a small round hut lined with earthenware pots, where a few chickens pecked in an alternating rhythm. I could see two more huts in the wide grass yard that stretched out behind the house. Beneath a tall mango tree, a pair of bony red cows looked up at us before returning to feed. Home squared.
Hey, Obama!
A big woman with a scarf on her head strode out of the main house, drying her hands on the side of her flowered skirt. She had a face like Saeed's, smooth and big-boned, with sparkling, laughing eyes. She hugged Alma and Roy as if she were going to wrestle them to the ground, then turned to me and grabbed my hand in a hearty handshake.
Hello,
she said, attempting English.
Musawa,
I said in Luo. She laughed, saying something to Alma.
She says she has dreamed about this day, Alma translated, when she would finally meet this son of her son. She says you have brought her great happiness. She says that now you have finally come home.
Granny nodded and pulled me into a hug before leading us into the house. Small windows let in little of the afternoon light, and the house was sparsely furnished. A few wooden chairs, a coffee table, a worn couch. On the walls were various family artifacts. The old man's Harvard diploma, photographs of him and of Omar, the uncle who had left for America 25 years ago and had never come back. Beside these were two older, yellowing photographs, the first of a tall young woman with smoldering eyes, a plump infant in her lap, a young girl standing beside her. The second, of an older man in a high-backed chair. The man was dressed in a starched shirt and a conga. His legs were crossed like an Englishman's, but across his lap was what appeared to be some sort of club, its heavy head wrapped in an animal skin. His high cheekbones and narrow eyes gave his face an Oriental cast. Alma came up beside me. "That's him, our grandfather. The woman in the picture beside it is our other grandmother, Akumu. The girl is Sara. And the baby? That's the old man." I studied the pictures for some time, until I noticed one last picture on the wall. It was a vintage print, the kind that grace old Coca-Cola ads, of a white woman with thick dark hair and slightly dreamy eyes. I asked her what the print was doing here, and Alma turned to Granny, who answered in Luo. "She says that is the picture of one of our grandfather's wives. He told people that he had married her in Burma when he was in the war." Roy laughed. "She doesn't look very Burmese, eh, Barak?" I shook my head. She looked like my mother. We sat down in the living room, and Granny made us some tea. She explained that things were well, although she had given away some of the land to relatives, since she and Yusuf could not work it all by themselves. She made up the lost income by selling lunches to the children at the nearby school, and bringing goods from Kisumu to the local market whenever she had some spare cash. Her only real problems were with the roof of the house. She pointed to a few threads of sunlight that ran from the ceiling to the floor, and the fact that she hadn't heard anything from her son Omar in over a year. She asked if I had seen him, and I had to say no. She grunted something in Luo, then started to gather up our cups. "She says when you see him, you should tell him she wants nothing from him," Alma whispered, "only that he should come visit his mother." I looked at Granny, and for the first time since our arrival, her age showed on her face. After we unpacked our bags, Roy gestured for me to follow him into the backyard. At the edge of a neighboring cornfield, at the foot of a mango tree, I saw two long rectangles of cement, jutting out of the earth like a pair of exhumed coffins. There was a plaque on one of the graves. Hussein Onyango Obama. Born 1895, died 1979. The other was covered with yellow bathroom tiles, with a bare space on the headstone where the plaque should have been. Roy bent down and brushed away a train of ants that marched across the length of the grave. "6 years," Roy said. 6 years and there's still nothing to say who's buried here. I tell you now, Barak, when I die, you make sure that my name is on the grave." He shook his head slowly before heading back toward the house. How to explain the emotions of that day? I can summon each moment in my mind, almost frame by frame. I remember Alma and myself joining Granny at the afternoon market, the same clearing where the Matatu had first dropped us off, only now full of women who sat on straw mats, their smooth brown legs sticking straight out in front of them from under white skirts, the sound of their laughter as they watched me help Granny pick stems off collard greens that she'd brought from Kisumu, and the nutty sweet taste of a sugarcane stalk that one of the women put into my hand. I remember the rustle of the corn leaves, the concentration on my uncle's faces, the smell of our sweat as we mended a hole in the fence bounding the western line of the property. I remember how in the afternoon a young boy named Godfrey appeared in the compound, a boy who Alma explained was staying with Granny because his family lived in a village where there was no school. I remember Godfrey's frantic steps as he chased a big black rooster through the banana and papaya trees, the knot in his young brow as the bird kept flapping out of his reach, the look in his eyes when finally Granny grabbed the rooster from behind with one hand and unceremoniously drew her knife across the bird's neck, a look that I remembered as my own. It wasn't simple joy that I felt in each of these moments. Rather, it was a sense that everything I was doing, every touch and breath and word, carried the full weight of my life, that a circle was beginning to close, so that I might finally recognize myself as I was, here, now, in one place. Only once that afternoon would I feel that mood broken, when, on our way back from the market, Alma ran ahead to get her camera, leaving Granny and me alone in the middle of the road. After a long pause, Granny looked at me and smiled. "Hello," she said. "Musawa," I said. Our mutual vocabulary exhausted, we stared ruefully down at the dirt until Alma finally returned. And Granny then turned to Alma and said, in a tone I could understand, that it pained her not to be able to speak to the son of her son. "Tell her I'd like to learn Luo, but it's hard to find the time in the States," I said. "Tell her how busy I am." "She understands that," Alma said. "But she also says that a man can never be too busy to know his own people." The next day, the women were gathered on straw mats under the shade of a mango tree, while Granny braided Alma's hair and Zaituni braided the hair of a neighbor's girl. Sitting down beside them, I asked Granny to tell me about my grandfather, from the beginning. And under the fanning shade of a mango tree, as hands wove black curls into even rows, I heard all our voices beginning to run together, the sound of three generations tumbling over each other like the currents of a slow-moving stream, my questions like rocks roiling the water, the breaks in memories separating the currents, but always the voices returning to that single course, a single story. First, there was Miwiru. It's not known who came before. Miwiru sired Sigoma. Sigoma sired Owini. Owini sired Kisori. Kisori sired Ogelo. Ogelo sired Otondi. Otondi sired Obongo. Obongo sired Okoth, and Okoth sired Opio. The women who bore them, their names are forgotten, for that was the way of our people. Okoth lived in Alego. Before that, it is known only that the families traveled a great distance, from the direction of what is now Uganda, and that we were like the Maasai, migrating in search of water and grazing land for great herds of cattle. In Alego, the people settled and began to grow crops. Once people began to settle and farm, the land in Alego became crowded. Opio, son of Okoth, decided to move to Kendu Bay. When he moved there, he was landless. But in the custom of our people, a man could use any unused land. He worked in the compounds of other men and cleared the land for his own farm. But before he could prosper, he died very young, leaving behind two wives and several children. One wife was taken in by Opio's brother, as was the custom then. She became the brother's wife, her children his children. But the other wife also died, and her oldest son, Obama, was orphaned when still a boy. He too lived with his uncle, but the resources of the family were strained, and so as Obama grew older, he began to work for other men as his father had done before him. The family he worked for was wealthy, with many cattle, but they came to admire Obama, for he was enterprising and a very good farmer. When he sought to marry their oldest daughter, they agreed, and the uncles in this family provided the necessary dowry. And when this eldest daughter died, they agreed that Obama could marry the younger daughter, whose name was Naoki. Eventually, Obama had four wives, who bore him many children. He cleared his own land and became prosperous, with a large compound and many cattle and goats. And because of his politeness and responsible ways, he became an elder in Kindu, and many came to seek his advice. Your grandfather, Onyango, was Nyaoki's fifth son. Even from the time that he was a boy, your grandfather Onyango was strange. He would wander off on his own for many days, and when he returned, he would not say where he had been. He was very serious always. He never laughed or played games with the other children, and never made jokes. He was always curious about other people's business, which is how he learned to be an herbalist. As a boy, your grandfather sat in the hut of the herbalist in his village, watching and listening carefully while the other boys played, and in this way he gained knowledge. When your grandfather was still a boy, we began to hear that the white man had come to Kisumu Town. It was said that these white men had skin as soft as a child's, but that they rode on a ship that roared like thunder, and had sticks that burst with fire. Before this time, no one in our village had seen white men, only Arab traders who sometimes came to sell us sugar and cloth. But even that was rare, for our people did not use much sugar, and we did not wear cloth, only a goatskin that covered our genitals. When the elders heard these stories, they discussed it among themselves and advised the men to stay away from Kisumu until this white man was better understood. Despite this warning, Onyango became curious and decided that he must see these white men for himself. One day he disappeared, and no one knew where he had gone. Then, Many months later, while Obama's other sons were working the land, Onyango returned to the village. He was wearing the trousers of a white man, and a shirt like a white man, and shoes that covered his feet. The small children were frightened, and his brothers didn't know what to make of this change. They called on their father, Obama, who came out of his hut, and the family gathered round to stare at Onyango's strange appearance. "What has happened to you?" Obama asked. "Why do you wear these strange skins?" Onyango said nothing, and Obama decided that Onyango must be wearing trousers to hide the fact that he was circumcised, which was against Luo custom. He thought that Onyango's shirt must be covering a rash or sores. Obama turned to his other sons and said, "Don't go near this brother of yours. He is unclean." Then he returned to his hut, and the others laughed and shunned Onyango. Because of this, Onyango returned to Kisumu, and he would remain estranged from his father for the rest of his life. Things began to change with the first of the white man's wars. During this time, your grandfather worked for the white man. Few people could speak English or Swahili in those days. Men didn't like to send their sons to the white man's school, preferring that they work with them on the land. But Onyango had learned to read and write, and understood the white man's system of paper records and land titles. This made him useful to the white man, and during the war he was put in charge of road crews. Eventually he was sent to Tanganyika, where he stayed for several years. When he finally returned, he cleared land for himself in Kindu, but it was far away from his father's compound, and he rarely spoke to his brothers. He didn't build a proper hut for himself, but instead lived in a tent. People had never seen such a thing, and they thought he was crazy. After he had staked his claim, he traveled to Nairobi, where a white man had offered him a job. He was not the only one who moved to town. After the war, many Africans began working for wages, especially those who had been conscripted, or lived near the cities, or had joined the white missions. Many people had been displaced during and immediately following the war. Your grandfather prospered. In his job in Nairobi, he learned how to prepare the white man's food and organize the white man's house. Because of this, he was popular with employers and worked in the estates of some of the most important white men, even Lord Delamere. He saved his wages and bought land and cattle in Kindu. Finally, he found a wife, a woman named Halima. It is not known how she felt towards your grandfather, but she was quiet and polite, and most important, she could maintain your grandfather's high housekeeping standards. He built a hut for her in Kindu, where she spent most of her time. Sometimes he would bring her to Nairobi to stay in the house where he worked. After a few years had passed, it was discovered that Halima could not bear any children. Among the Luo, this was normally proper grounds for divorce. A man could send a barren wife back to his in-laws and ask that his dowry be returned. But your grandfather chose to keep Halima, and in that sense, he treated her well. Still, it must have been lonely for Halima, for your grandfather worked all the time and had no time for friends or entertainment. He did not drink with other men, and he did not smoke tobacco. His only pleasure was going to the dance halls in Nairobi once a month, for he liked to dance. But he also was not such a good dancer. He was rough and would bump into people and step on their feet. Most people didn't say anything about this because they knew Onyango and his temper. One night, though, a drunken man began to complain about Onyango's clumsiness. The man became rude and told your grandfather, "Onyango, you are already an older man. You have many cattle and you have a wife, and yet you have no children. Tell me, is something the matter between your legs?" People who overheard the conversation began to laugh, and Onyango beat this man severely. But the drunk man's words must have stayed with your grandfather, for that month he set out to find another wife. He returned to Kindu and inquired about all the women in the village. Finally, he made up his mind on a young girl named Akumu, who was well regarded for her beauty. She was already promised to another man, who had paid her father 6 cattle in dowry, promising to deliver 6 more in the future. But Onyango knew the girl's father, and he convinced him to send back these 6 cattle. In return, Onyango gave him 15 cattle on the spot. By the time I came to live with him, Akumu had already borne Onyango 2 children. The first was Sarah. 3 years later came your father, Barak. I did not know Akumu well, for she and her children lived with Halima on your grandfather's compound in Kindu, while I stayed with him in Nairobi, to help him with his work there. But whenever I accompanied your grandfather to Kindu, I could see that Akumu was unhappy. Halima tried to help Akumu, and cared for the children as if they were her own, but it didn't help. Life became easier for her when the Second World War came. Your grandfather went overseas as the cook to the British captain, and I came to live with Akumu and Halima, helping both with the children and their crops. We did not see Onyango for some time. He traveled widely with the British regiments, to Burma and Ceylon, to Arabia, and to somewhere in Europe. When he returned 3 years later, he came with a gramophone and that picture of the woman he claimed to have married in Burma. Onyango was now almost 50. More and more he thought of quitting his work for the white man and returning to farm the land. He saw, though, that the land surrounding Kindu was crowded and overgrazed, so his mind went back to Alego, the land that his grandfather had abandoned. One day he came to his wives and told us that we should prepare ourselves to leave for Alego. When we arrived in Alego, most of this land that you see now was bush, and life was hard for all of us. But your grandfather had studied modern farming techniques while in Nairobi, and he put his ideas to work. He could make anything grow, and in less than a year he had grown enough crops to sell at market. He smoothed out the earth to make this wide lawn, and cleared the fields where his crops grew high and plentiful. He planted the mango and banana and pawpaw trees that you see today. He even sold most of his cattle because he said that their grazing made the soil poor and caused it to wash away. With this money, he built large huts for Akumu and myself, and a hut of his own. He had brought back a crystal set from England that he displayed on a shelf, and on his gramophone he played strange music late into the night. When my first children, Omar and Zaituni, were born, he bought them cribs and gowns and separate mosquito nets, just as he had for Barak and Sera. In the cooking hut, he built an oven in which he baked bread and cakes like you buy in a store. His neighbors in Alego had never seen such things. At first they were suspicious of him and thought he was foolish, especially when he sold his cattle. But soon they came to respect his generosity, as well as what he taught them about farming and herbal medicines. Even if Onyango had used one of these medicines on Akumu, I don't think he could have made her happy. No matter how much he beat her, she would argue with him. She was also proud and scornful of me, and often refused to help in the household chores. She had a third child, named Alma, like this one sitting here, and as she nursed this new baby, she secretly planned her escape. One night, when Sarah was 12 and Barak was 9, she made her move. She woke up Sarah and said that she was running away to Kindu. She told Sarah that it was too difficult a journey for children to make at night, but said that they should follow her as soon as they were older. Then she disappeared with her baby into the darkness. When Onyango found out what had happened, he was furious. At first, he thought he should let Akumu go. But when he saw that Barak and Sarah were still young, and that even I, with two children of my own, was little more than a girl, he went to Akumu's family in Kendu and asked that she be returned. But the family refused. They had come to hear how harshly Onyango treated Akumu, and in fact had already accepted a dowry for Akumu's remarriage to another man. Together, Akumu and her new husband had left for Tanganyika. There was nothing Onyango could do, so he returned to Alego. He said to himself, "It does not matter," and he told me that I was now the mother of all his children. Neither he nor I knew of Akumu's last visit to Sarah, but Sarah had remembered her mother's instructions, and only a few weeks passed before she woke up Barak in the middle of the night, just as her mother had done to her. She told Barak to be quiet, helped him get dressed, and together they began to walk down the road to Kindu. I still wonder that they both survived. They were gone for almost 2 weeks, walking many miles each day, hiding from those who passed them on the road, sleeping in fields and begging for food. Not far from Kindu they became lost, and a woman finally saw them and took pity on them, for they were filthy and almost starved. The woman took them in and fed them and asked them their names, and when she realized who they were, she sent for your grandfather. And when Onyango came to get them and saw how badly they looked, this is the only time that anyone ever saw him cry. The children never tried to run away again, but I don't think they ever forgot this journey they made. Sarah kept a careful distance from Onyango, and in her heart remained loyal to Akumu, for she was older and perhaps had seen how the old man had treated her mother. I believe she also resented me for taking her mother's place. Barak reacted differently. He could not forgive his abandonment, and acted as if Akumu didn't exist. He told everyone that I was his mother, and although he would send Akumu money when he became a man, to the end of his life he would always act coldly towards her. The strange thing was that in many ways Sarah was most like her father in personality. strict, hardworking, easy to anger, whereas Barak was wild and stubborn like a Kumu. But of course, such things one does not see in oneself. As you might expect, Onyango was very strict with his children. He worked them hard and would not allow them to play outside the compound because he said other children were filthy and ill-mannered. Whenever Onyango went away, I would ignore these instructions because children must play with other children, just as they must eat and sleep. But I would never tell your grandfather what I did, and I would have to scrub the children clean before your grandfather came home. This was not easy, especially with Barak. That boy was so mischievous. In Onyango's presence, he appeared well-mannered and obedient, and never answered back when his father told him to do something. But behind the old man's back, Barak did as he pleased. When Onyango was away on business, Barak would take off his proper clothes and go off with the other boys to wrestle or swim in the river, to steal the fruit from the neighbors' trees, or ride their cows. The neighbors were afraid to go directly to Onyango, so they would come to me and complain about these things. But I could not get mad at Barak, and would always cover up his foolishness from Onyango, for I loved him as my own son. Although he did not like to show it, your grandfather was also very fond of Barak, because the boy was so clever. When Barak was only a baby, Onyango would teach him the alphabet and numbers, and it was not long before the son could outdo the father in these things. This pleased Onyango, for to him knowledge was the source of all the white man's power, and he wanted to make sure that his son was as educated as any white man. He was less concerned with Sarah's education, although she was also quick like Barak. Most men thought educating their daughters was a waste of money. This created more friction between Sarah and her younger brother, especially because she knew that Barak was not always serious about his studies. Everything came too easily to him. At first he went to the mission school nearby, but he came back after the first day and told his father that he could not study there because his class was taught by a woman, and he knew everything she had to teach him. This attitude he had learned from his father, so Onyango could say nothing. The next closest school was 6 miles away, and I began to walk him to this school every morning. His teacher there was a man, but Barak discovered this didn't solve his problems. He always knew the answers, and sometimes he would even correct the teacher's mistakes before the whole class. The teacher would scold Barak for his insolence, but Barak would refuse to back down. This caused Barak many canings at the hand of the headmaster. But it also might have taught him something, because the next year, when he switched to a class with a woman teacher, I noticed that he didn't complain. Still, he was bored with school, and when he became older, he would stop going to school altogether for weeks at a time. A few days before exams, he would find a classmate and read through the lessons. He could sit down and teach himself everything in just a few days, and when the marks came in, he would always be first. The few times he didn't come in first, he came to me in tears, for he was so used to being the best. But this happened only once or twice. Usually he would come home laughing and boasting of his cleverness. By the time your father was a teenager, things were rapidly changing in Kenya. People began to talk about independence. Meetings and demonstrations were held, and petitions were presented to the administration complaining about land confiscations and the power of chiefs to commission free labor for government projects. Like other boys, your father would be influenced by the early talk of independence, and he would come home from school talking about the meetings he had seen. Your grandfather agreed with many of the demands of the early parties like KANU, but he remained skeptical that the independence movement would lead to anything because he thought Africans could never win against the white man's army. Despite this attitude, your grandfather would once find himself detained. An African who worked for the district commissioner was jealous of your grandfather's lands. This man had once been rebuked by your grandfather because he would collect excessive taxes and pocket the money for himself. During the emergency, this man placed Onyango's name on a list of KANU supporters and told the white man that Onyango was a subversive. One day, the white man's soldiers came to take Onyango away, and he was placed in a detention camp. Eventually, he received a hearing, and he was found innocent. But he had been in camp for over 6 months, and when he returned to Alego, he was very thin and dirty. He had difficulty walking, and his head was full of lice. He was so ashamed he refused to enter his house or tell us what had happened. Barak was away at the time, and only learned about this detention later. He had taken the district examinations and had been admitted to Maseno Mission School, some 50 miles south. This should have been a great honor for Barak, because few Africans then were allowed to get secondary education, and only the best students got into Maseno. But your father's rebellious nature caused the school much grief. He would sneak girls into his dormitory. He and his friends would raid nearby farms for chickens and yams because they did not like the dormitory food. The teachers at the school overlooked many of these infractions, for they saw how smart he was. But eventually, Barak went too far with his mischief and was finally expelled. Onyango was so furious when he found out, he beat Barak with a stick until Barak's back was bleeding. But Barak refused to run or cry out or even explain himself to his father. The following week, Onyango told Barak that he had arranged for him to travel to the coast, where he would work as a clerk. Barak had no choice but to obey his father. He went to Mombasa and took the job, in the office of an Arab merchant. But after a short time, he had an argument with the Arab and left without collecting his pay. He found another clerk's job, but it paid much less. He was too proud to ask his father for help, or admit that he had been wrong. Nevertheless, word got back to Onyango, and when Barak came home for a visit, his father shouted to him that he would amount to nothing. Barak tried to tell Onyango that the new job paid much better than the one Onyango had arranged. He said that he was earning 150 shillings every month. Onyango knew that his son had lied. He went into his hut and told Barak to go away because he had brought shame on his father. Barak moved to Nairobi and found a job working as a clerk for the railway. But he was bored, and he became distracted by the politics of the country. The Kikuyu had begun their warfare in the forests. Everywhere there were rallies calling for Kenyatta's release from prison. Barak began to attend political meetings after work and came to know some of the KANU leadership. At one of these meetings, the police came, and Barak was arrested for violating the meeting law. He was jailed and sent word to his father that he needed money for bail. But Onyango refused to give Barak the money that he asked for and told me that his son needed to learn his lesson well. Because he was not a leader in KANU, Barak was released after a few days. But there was no happiness in his release, for he had begun to think that perhaps what his father had said was true, that he would amount to nothing. He was a man of 20, and what did he have? He had been fired from his railway job, he was estranged from his father, without money or prospects, and he now had a wife and child. He had met Kazia when he was only 18. She lived in Kindu with her family then. He was struck by her beauty, and after a brief courtship, he decided that he would marry her. To do so, he knew that his father would have to help him with the dowry, and so he asked me to intercede on his behalf. 1 year after Barak and Kazia were married, Roy was born. 2 years later came Alma. To support this family, Barak had to take any work he could find, and he finally convinced another Arab, named Suleiman, to take him on as an office boy. But Barak remained deeply depressed, almost desperate. Barak saw that he might end up working as the clerk of these men for the rest of his life. Then good fortune struck, in the form of two American women. They were teaching in Nairobi, connected to some religious organization, and one day they came into the office where Barak was working. Your father struck up a conversation with them, and soon these women became his friends. They loaned him books to read and invited him to their house, and when they saw how smart he was, they told him that he should go to a university. He explained that he had no money and no secondary school certificate, but these women said they could arrange for him to take a correspondence course that would give him the certificate he needed. If he was successful, they said, they would try to help him get into a university in America. Barak became very excited and immediately rode away for this correspondence course. For the first time in his life, he worked diligently. Every night and during his lunch hours, he would study his books and do the lessons in his notebooks. A few months later, he sat for the exam at the American Embassy. The exam took several months to score, and during this wait, he was so nervous he could barely eat. He became so thin that we all thought he would die. Then one day, the letter came. I was not there to see him open it. I know that when he told me the news, he was still shouting with happiness. He still had no money, though, and no university had yet accepted him. Onyango had softened towards his son when he saw that he was becoming more responsible, but even he could not raise the money to pay university fees and transport abroad. So Barak wrote to the universities in America. He wrote and he wrote. Finally, a university in Hawaii wrote back and told him that they would give him a scholarship. No one knew where this place was, but Barak didn't care. He gathered up his pregnant wife and son and dropped them off with me, and in less than a month he was gone. What happened in America, I cannot say. I know that after less than 2 years, we received a letter from Barak saying that he had met this American girl, Anne, and that he would like to marry her. Now, Barry, I know that you have heard that your grandfather disapproved of this marriage. This is true, but it is not for the reasons you say. You see, Onyango did not believe your father was behaving responsibly. He wrote back to Barak saying, "How can you marry this white woman when you have responsibilities at home? Will this woman return with you and live as a Luo woman? Will she accept that you already have a wife and children? I have not heard of white people understanding such things. Their women are jealous and used to being pampered. But if I am wrong in this matter, let the girl's father come to my hut and discuss the situation properly. For this is the affair of elders, not children." He also wrote to your grandfather, Stanley, and said many of these same things. As you know, your father went ahead with the marriage. He only told Onyango what had happened after you were born. We are all happy that this marriage took place, because without it, we would not have you with us here now. But your grandfather was very angry at the time, and threatened to have Barak's visa revoked. And because he had lived with white people, perhaps Onyango did understand the white people's customs, better than Barak did. For when Barak finally returned to Kenya, we discovered that you and your mother had stayed behind, just as Onyango had warned. Soon after Barak came, a white woman arrived in Kisumu looking for him. At first, we thought this must be your mother, Anne. Barak had to explain that this was a different woman, Ruth. He said that he had met her at Harvard and that she had followed him to Kenya without his knowledge. I know that once Barak agreed to marry Ruth, she could not accept the idea of having Kazia as a second wife. That is how the children went to live with their father and his new wife in Nairobi. When Barak brought Roy and Alma back to visit, Ruth would have refused to accompany him and would not let Barak bring David or Mark. The others have told you what happened to your father in Nairobi. We saw him rarely, and he would usually stay only for a short time. Whenever he came, he would bring us expensive gifts and money and impress all the people with his big car and fine clothes. But your grandfather continued to speak harshly to him, as if he were a boy. Onyango was now very old. He walked with a cane and was almost blind. He could not even bathe without my help, which I think caused him shame. But age did not soften his temper. Later, when Barak fell from power, he would try to hide his problems from the old man. He continued to bring gifts that he could no longer afford, although we noticed that he arrived in a taxi instead of his own car. Only to me would he confide his unhappiness and disappointments. I would tell him he was too stubborn in his dealings with the government. He would talk to me about principles, and I would tell him that his principles weighed too heavily on his children. He would say I didn't understand, just as his father had said to me. So I stopped giving advice, and just listened. That is what Barak needed most, I think, someone to listen to him. Even after things had improved again for him, and he had built this house for us, he remained heavy-hearted. With his children, he behaved just as Onyango had behaved towards him. He saw that he was pushing them away, but there was nothing he could do. He still liked to boast and laugh and drink with the men, but his laughter was empty. I remember the last time he visited Onyango before the old man died. The two of them sat in their chairs, facing each other and eating their food, but no words passed between them. A few months later, when Onyango finally went to join his ancestors, Barak came home to make all the arrangements. He said very little, and it's only when he sorted through a few of the old man's belongings that I saw him begin to weep.
Context of white supremacy. The number to dial is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Again, book club, these are all study sessions. Looking forward to hearing an exchange of views. So folks out there, if you are listening, again, the number to dial is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-POUND. Press *6 and let us not wait until the last minute. Before I get the hands, I'm going to try to get some of the omissions. I hate abridged books. That is one thing, one lesson that I will take away from Dreams from My Father. Abridged books are awful. They are just awful. You really are. Your entire reading experience is subject to what whomever the editor, whomever that person is, what they decide to leave in the text. At any rate, let's see. And this one was really bad because it wasn't like before where they would take out whole chunks. This is one of those where it looks like they would just take out like three or four sentences. Like you'd be in the paragraph and they would just snatch three or four sentences out and keep rolling. So I'm going to try and get a couple of these really quick and then hit the phone lines. Okay. Okay, so this is when they are talking about President Obama's grandfather, Onyango. Let's see. Okay. When your grandfather was still a boy, we began to hear that the white man had come to Kisumu town. It was said that these white men had skin as soft as a child's, but that they rode on a ship that roared like thunder and had sticks that burst with fire. Before this time, no one in our village had seen white men, only Arab traders who sometimes came to sell us sugar and cloth. But even that was rare, for our people did not use much sugar, and we did not wear cloth. This part is in the book, was in the audiobook. Only a goat skin that covered our genitals. When the elders heard these stories, they discussed it among themselves and advised the men to stay away from Kisumu until the white man was better understood. Despite this warning, Onyango became curious and decided that he must see these white men for himself. One day he disappeared and no one knew where he had gone. Then, many months later, while Obama's other sons were working the land, Onyango returned to the village. He was wearing the trousers of a white man and a shirt like a white man and shoes that covered his feet. The small children were frightened and his brothers didn't know what to make of this change. They called Obama, who came out of his hut, and the family gathered round to stare at Oyango's strange appearance. I think actually that all of that portion was in the text, but I highlighted that for a different reason. I highlighted it just because I think that is a portion that white people would dig. The black people, non-white people, not having any clothes, being backwards and primitive, just wearing some sort of goat skin to cover themselves. I could see that being something white people would like, that primitive, pitiful image of black people destitute, basically, unless white people come around to teach them something. Okay, this is one that was not in the audiobook. This is just a couple paragraphs down from what I just read. Things began to change with the first of the white man's wars. More guns arrived, along with a white man who called himself District Commissioner. We called this man Bwana Ogalo, which meant the oppressor. He imposed a hut tax that had to be paid in the white man's money. This forced many men to work for wages. He conscripted outright many of our men into his army to carry provisions and build a road that would allow automobiles to pass. He surrounded himself with Luos, who wore clothes like the white man, to serve as his agents and tax collectors. We learned that we now had chiefs, men who were not even in the council of elders. All these things were resisted, and many men began to fight, but those who did so were beaten or shot. Those who failed to pay taxes saw their huts burned to the ground. Some families fled farther into the countryside to start new villages. But most people stayed and learned to live with this new situation, although we now realized that it had been foolish to ignore the white man's arrival. And like I said, they will include like a sentence or two, and then they will omit three or four sentences. So moving forward, okay, so this is just a couple paragraphs down from what I just read. Some men began to try to organize against these policies to petition and hold demonstrations, but their numbers were few, and most people just struggled to live. Those Africans who did not work as laborers stayed in their villages trying to maintain the old ways. But even in the villages, attitudes changed. The land was crowded for the new systems of land ownership. There was no longer room for sons to start their own plots. Everything was owned by someone. respect for tradition weakened, for young people saw that the elders had no real power. Beer, which once had been made of honey, and which men drank only sparingly, now came in bottles, and many men became drunks. Many of us began to taste the white man's life, and we decided that compared to him, our lives were poor. That is that was definitely omitted, and that is one that I had double highlighted, that white people would love a paragraph like that. I'm going to try to go quick so I can get the phone lines. Should only be one or two more omissions that I thought really stood out. Okay, one right here. Now, this is maybe two or three pages down from what I just read. Like other boys, your father would be influenced by the early talk of independence, and he would come home from school talking about the meetings he had seen. Your grandfather agreed with many of the demands of the early parties, like KANU, but he remained skeptical that the independence movement would lead to anything because he thought Africans could never win against the white man's army. I think that portion was in the audiobook. How can the African defeat the white man? He would tell Barack. When he cannot even make his own bicycle. And he would say that the African could never win against the white man because the black man only wanted to work with his own family or clan, while all white men worked to increase their power. The white man alone is like an ant, Oyango would say. He can be easily crushed, but like an ant, the white man works together. His nation, his business, these things are more important to him than himself. He will follow his leaders and not question orders. Black men are not like this. Even the most foolish black man thinks he knows better than the wise man. This is why the black man will always lose. Significant that they left that out, I thought. There was one more that they omitted that I wanted to share. Oh, here we go. Okay. Last one, then we'll hit the phone lines. This is just a couple paragraphs down from what I just read. Some of this was included, but as I said, they did the they would skip over a sentence or two. So some of this was in, but then some of this was not in. As you know, your father went ahead with the marriage to Ruth, the white woman. He told Oyango what had happened after you were born. Oh, wait a minute. This is Anne. Sorry, wrong white woman. There's so many of them. I got confused. As you know, your father went ahead with the marriage. He only told Oyango what had happened after you were born. We were all happy that this marriage took place because without it, we would not have you here with us now. But your grandfather was very angry at the time and threatened to have Barack's visa revoked. And because he had lived with white people, perhaps Oyango did understand the white people's customs better than Barack did. For when Barack finally returned to Kenya, we discovered that you and your mother had stayed behind, just as Oyango had warned. Soon after Barack came, a white woman arrived in Kisumu looking for him. At first, we thought this must be your mother, Anne. Barack had to explain that this was a different white woman. They got confused too. Ruth. He said that he had met her at Harvard and that she had followed him to Kenya without his knowledge. Your grandfather didn't believe this story and thought that again Barack had disobeyed him. But I wasn't so sure, for in fact, Barack did seem reluctant to marry Ruth at first. I'm not sure what finally swayed him. Maybe he felt Ruth would be better suited to his new life. Or maybe he heard gossip that Kiza had enjoyed herself too much during his absence, even though I told him that this gossip was not true. Or maybe he just cared for Ruth more than he liked to admit. Whatever the reason, I know that once Barack agreed to marry Ruth, she could not accept the idea of him having Kiza as a second wife. That is how the children went to live with their father and his new wife in Nairobi. When Barack brought Alma and Roy back to visit, Ruth would refuse to accompany him and would not let Barack bring David or Mark. Oyango did not discuss this directly with Barack, but he would say to his friends in such a way that Barack could hear him, "My son is a big man, but when he comes home to his mother," I'll read this one more time. "My son is a big man, but when he comes home, his mother must cook for him instead of his wife." There we go. I will stop there. I thought that was quite significant, especially given what we included last week about Ruth and her disdain for Barack Obama's father. And she was saying that it was probably good fortune that Barack Obama, the president, had not met his father, and that probably explained why he had excelled and been able to do so well, his lack of contact with his father. Very significant, I thought. Anywho, Be More and Shadow, your lines are open. Any other callers, I will open your lines as I see hands.
Peace, Gus, and all the other listeners. And I'll start off by saying thank you for my shout-out, for lack of a better word, but to the text. I wrote down how he talked about his description of black women again. He talked about his granny being a big woman and her being big-boned, and then he turns around and describes white women in a better fashion, like white women with the white woman with thick hair and dreamy eyes who looked like my mother. So just his description of people really stands out to me. And then when he was also noted, when you were talking about the white people with skin as soft as a child, I don't know, hearing that whole little thing, I thought of weakness, white people being weak, that they need tools or weapons to make them strong. Because I believe he said they came in on boats and sticks of fire and things like that. I also wrote down what you were talking about as far as Ruth and how she followed him. His father said against his will, but then this is the same woman who she followed him to Africa. This is the same woman who basically talks so negatively about him and doesn't want to treat his children, of course, the same as her children, non-white children with a white parent. And then I also noted how the omission, how they talked about white men working together to increase their power, but blacks, basically non-whites, we have no unity, so we'll always lose. And then the last thing I noted is when, I believe it was President Barack Obama's uncle, when he was dressing like a white man, his father called him unclean. And there was also talk of how they didn't want to send their children to white man schools. And I was just thinking where we'd be possibly if we still had that mindset of not wanting to go to white men's schools and follow the white man's rules and things like that. But yeah, and also wanted to say that these omissions are definitely no mistake. They know what to put in and what to leave out.
Well said. Well said. I made an error. I said Shadow. I got my callers mixed up. So that would be Be More, Brooklyn caller, and person 9103. Your lines are all open.
Good evening, Gus and callers. I found also it would be more saying about the way he was described the black female in his family as a big woman. I mean, like, I haven't heard him describe any white people in such a way. You know, the problem is white people, and when we kind of share their opinions, and that's when, you know, we become successful in their system or whatever. So it's like, you know, it's kind of share the same mindset. So the description becomes the same, the narrative, it's very objectifying. Also, I mean, just like from, I haven't really been sharing much. I've been catching up on the archives with the this particular book, but it seems like whenever he's doing black people's voices, he kind of does it up like he's acting a whole bunch. But then when it's white people, they sound like him, you know. I found it interesting the way when he, just one little part where he was saying that they hadn't really seen any white people before except for Arabs. I found that kind of interesting because I feel like a lot of people are confused and call and consider all Arabs to be non-white people, but it seems to me that not that isn't the case. And another interesting thing, this coincidence is where you were talking, he was talking about the ant, you mentioned he was relating white people to ants, how one white man is like an ant. And earlier today, I'm working right now, but earlier today, before the program came on, I was listening to the archives, old archives, and I was listening to a program with Professor Griff. And you were interviewing Professor Griff, and Mr. Nero called and asked a question. He asked Professor Griff if he had ever, because earlier in the program, you were talking about Tim Wise, and apparently Professor Griff knew Tim Wise and was giving him some accolades and talking about that, you know, he was a, you know, really brilliant guy, and, you know, how he's like God sent. You're trying to let him know how Tim Wise is kind of a, you know, he's a suspected racist, you know, just like any other white person. But he asked Professor Griff if he had ever had ant problems in his house, and he this was just earlier today, so I was just kind of funny how that was the second time today that I heard somebody relating white people to ants, and just, you know, there's that, you know, one ant, you know, you can overlook one ant. When you get, you know, that critical mass of ants, you have a, you know, a serious problem. Some things it jumped out to me.
That is so funny. I remember that. That is hilarious. That is hilarious. that is from August. If anyone wants to hit the... I'm getting background noise. Picking up background noise. We had two other callers join the line. Shadow, I was just a little early. I had said his name already. Shadow should be with us. And 1804 with us as well. The Professor Griff program that he's talking about is from August of 2010. Which is hilarious for a myriad of reasons, if you want to check that out. I'll mute my line.
One of the things that I noted, I'm not sure if this was read, but it was something that stood out to me, was when he talked about Africans accusing whites of distorting Christianity to demean everything African. It was a little bit before... saying that the African couldn't win against the white man because the black man only wanted to work with his own family or clan. Was that read?
I'm scrolling back to check right now.
It's about two paragraphs of...
So this is chapter 19?
I think so.
Okay.
It's the same chapter as that verse you read about. As that paragraph. It says, even Africans who had been educated in mission schools now rebelled against their home churches and accused whites of distorting Christianity to demean everything African. As before, most of this activity centered in Kukulian, for that tribe bore the white man's yoke most heavily. I don't remember hearing that. I might have missed it, though.
I don't think that was in. Do y'all remember hearing that?
No.
I don't remember that.
And that was like I said, it's a paragraph before talking about the unity of whites versus the unity of blacks. So that was one of the things that I highlighted, and I saw that. I didn't hear it. It seems like nobody else has either.
Then they do this stuff on purpose. Of course they want to do that.
This is 1804. I have to get back to the plantation, so I just wanted to put in a really quick comment. If anybody else noticed that Barack Sr. was lost in his studies and his direction until two white women came and fixed his studies abroad.
I had marked that point. I thought that was super important, given the contrast that B. Moore has brought up consistently about the black females are just big and, you know, they're large and husky. And the comparison he makes to white women, I think they are referenced, these two white women are referenced as good fortune for Barack Sr., that you would have been dilapidated and down and out if it were not for these white women coming in and making everything okay. I thought that was extremely important.
Yeah, it was like that part, it just switched over from Negro madness to white people to the rescue.
Greetings, can I be heard, Gus?
Yes, ma'am. Is that 404?
Yes, it is.
Wow, I feel like it should be theme music. Wow. Good to hear from you.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all of the callers and the listeners. Yes, I've been trying to play catch-up. I had I was out on assignment, so I've been away from everything. But I see that my husband has been keeping up with things for me. But anyway, what I called about, I'm going to go back a little bit because I happened to listen to the show from last week when he went to see Ruth, the stepmother, and his and her new husband and child. And it just goes, which ties into what B. Moore was saying with white women and their role in Obama's family. It showed how disrespectful she was to her husband when he was sitting up there. He was like an ornament in the house. Oh, don't you need to go to the club? And it's basically like he was chauffeuring the child around, the way she played with the child's hair, as if to make emphasis that if it wasn't for me being involved, then his hair would have not have been as flowing and curly in the way he described his brother with the honey skin color, and the stepfather, the new husband, as this old gray-haired looking black man sitting up there bouncing this child on his knees. And it just rubbed me the very wrong way, because it shows that how when black people are mentioned, we're either reduced to the butler role, the mammy role, the maid role, and white women are being elevated to this status of being all things prim and proper. And it just shows the selfish nature of white people in general, how this white woman supposedly followed him all the way to Africa. She got on a plane and just followed him there. She wanted to be married to him, but hey, you have to get rid of your first wife. She has got to go. So he had to make concessions and get rid of his wife, take the children and brought the children there. And the mistreatment and the abuse of these children went through at the hands of this woman, who always felt as if though these children were an intrusion, they were too much of a reminder of the past and his attachment that he had to his black side, and her attempt to completely sever him completely from that part of his life.
I agree. Did you hear the portion where they talk about Ruth again? This where I guess it was part of the omission, but I read it after the audio clip finished. Did you hear that part?
Yes, I heard a part that you read. What she did, it just rubbed me the very wrong way. And then his brother, the way how she was all over his brother, making him seem to be such a genius, and as if though the brains, possibly that she had more to do with him turning out intelligent, more so than his father, because as the aunts and everyone mentioned, the genius has always been in the family. As they might not have been as well educated, but they were always very highly intelligent people. And she's just trying to, at all costs that she could find, to throw water in their face to make it seem that they're some stupid, backward people who Barack Sr. just barely, you know, he just happened to got out of there and he got civilized, and he's not like the rest of y'all. But she still have this resentment towards this, towards the man. The man is long gone in his grave, and she still have this hatred and this disdain for him. Yeah, I would say that it's jealousy. I say it's bordering on jealousy that he has something that she could never capture, she could never get, because the essence, she wanted to smother him. She wanted to completely consume him, but he still kept this ties to his first wife, his children, his blackness, and she just wanted it completely gone. She wanted him to be gone, these people to be gone completely out of his life.
Since President Obama put this in the book, just if you were just basing your opinion on what you got from the text, the way he wrote it, the way he describes Ruth in these different segments, do you think he has the same opinion of Ruth just from what you've read, or do you think that he doesn't see her in that negative, racist manner?
I don't think he sees her in that way. As you have shown throughout this audiobook and reading this book, he finds a way to, what is called a Nuremberg defense, whereby it's a justification as to why white people do certain things to black people. It's that they have no control over it. It's that they were forced to do it. It was beyond their control, and they were just following orders. That is what is used to defend white people when they do racist things to black people. But when black people do something in a typical way, it's noted that we should have known better. We didn't have to react that way. We don't get that pass. But white people get that Nuremberg defense. Because that's the same thing that they used when they said that, oh, Hitler was in charge, we were just following his orders, and we put the people in the oven, and we just gas them or whatever, use that defense to get themselves out of the genocide that was committed in Europe. And that's the same defense I'm hearing him using when it comes to dealing with white people, is that some or the other, they were not, it's not really their fault. It's circumstances and everything that worked against them to put them in this position.
Yeah, I remember the passage from last week that was also omitted from the audiobook where President Obama, where he's, I think they're leaving Ruth's house that's in the suburbs where they've got black people, armed black people out making sure the area is secure when they're leaving. And he's talking to Alma and he says, well, maybe she's behaving that way because she misses him. Maybe that's the problem. She misses him really bad, and that's the way she's dealing with her grief. Is just to be really negative and disparaging about him, and to really dump all this praise on Mark and say that he got all of his intelligence from her and not the. I remember that from last week. Although I don't see that the passage from this week. I don't see him making excuses for her conduct in the one this week, but. It's a big difference. I think you see that consistently. I think the way I was phrasing it last week is him excusing racist behavior. And it seems especially women, I would say that's the pattern that I'm seeing it when white women, whether it's his grandmother or Ruth or his mom, the scene where they were watching the film Black Orpheus. And he's just like, oh, my God, this is some kind of racist fetish that she has of black people, where he finds a way to rationalize the behavior, especially for white women, which is not surprising since he does have a white parent. That's why I remember when I read this book and I was thinking, man, if you have an understanding of racism, white supremacy, there's a lot you can learn from this. Like just picking out those patterns with the white women alone would be, I would think that would be a lot of constructive value to it.
That's true. He goes over and above and beyond when it comes to dealing. And it would have to be because he was raised with his mother, his grandmother, and they instill, as he said, their values onto him, got him to think as a white person, even though he has feet in both worlds. But he never really got, as he said, into his blackness until he came to the mainland to go to college. But most of his life, or those 18 years, he was in essence operating as a pseudo-white person in black skin or brown skin.
Fascinating. I don't know if any of the other folks that have been listening to the sections with Ruth, did you all get the impression, like, if you were just going to go on the text, right, you're reading the text and you were trying to figure out what President Obama's feelings are about Ruth, if you just had to base it on what you read or what you heard in the text, do you think he thinks, wow, this is a conniving racist heifer, just talking bad about my dad and the whole nine? Or do you think that what you heard from 404, like the explaining, making excuses for her behavior, and he doesn't see her as a racist?
I think he has divided loyalties. I think I do agree with 404 to some extent, but I think there's things he says in the book that makes it clear that he does suspect her, but he's not sure. And I think it comes from him having a white mother. There's confusion.
Yeah, I don't think he's, this is 1804, I don't think he's crazy about Ruth, especially since she's a rival to his mother. But I do agree with most of 404's points. I think he talks about Ruth very matter-of-factly.
What you could see is when he looked at the album, when they pulled out the album and he looked at it and he saw them going to the beach, and he kind of imagined that if his mother would have taken his father back, then that would have been me instead in this picture. It would have been my mother instead of her in this picture taking over all my father's life, because I can tell that he kind of wished that his mother was there instead of this woman. He has a bit of ambivalence towards her. Because he felt, yeah, in a way that she took the place of his mother, what his mother would have been, because as we read in the beginning of the book where his mother said that she was the one who left the father, and he wanted to come back to her, but she kind of pushed him off. I don't know if she's just making herself feel better, but in that sense, he's just trying to make it seem this woman just, in essence, removed his mother out the way, instead of having her, you know, to retain her position or place where she was with his father.
Yeah, he kind of seemed like he was very he was like very casual, like he wasn't alarmed by her criticism of his father. Like, he didn't seem surprised or alarmed. It was just kind of like he wanted her to feel okay. Like, it's like he wanted to console her, you know. But I mean, I feel like the tone of the whole book, I mean, he doesn't really say anything positive overall about it. It's like, I feel like the whole, like the fact that the book is called Dreams of My Father, and then he doesn't really have anything, like, definitively positive to say about, you know, about his father. It's kind of speaks for itself. It's just kind of this a footnote, you know, like, you know, we're victims. I mean, so that's what we are. I don't know if that, you know, that makes sense, but just kind of confirming, you know, confirming the victimization as correct or something.
I think he's trying to maintain a neutral tone throughout the book, where he's trying not to take sides, but in some sense it seems that when he gets victimized, when he feels he's being victimized, for instance, with the white passenger on the plane sitting next to him, and how he felt when this guy just kicked back his seat and just went to sleep and said, oh, just wake me up. You know, you just meet someone on a plane, you don't even know them from Adam, and you're going to get all comfortable I'm going to go to sleep, just wake me up when they come by to serve the food. You know, it's just this way that white people have when it comes to dealing with black folks. You can tell in a few times where he just kind of really pricked and got under his skin.
Under his skin, those racist metaphors, there's tons of those. I'm trying to pay more attention to that now. Made my skin crawl. I think that's a signature, racist signature. They have all these metaphors. When something is bothering you, it's a skin affliction. I don't think that's coincidental at all. There's I just saw this, that they left this out. This is kind of mega important, I think. And I think they left all this. Man, I hate, we are never doing another abridged book ever. This is right under, this is at the close, like where the audio ended at, that we just heard. It's kind of at the end that they left all this out. I leaned back on the mat and thought about what Granny had said. There was a certain wisdom there, I supposed. She was speaking of a different time, another place, but I also understood Alma's frustration. I knew that, as I had been listening to the story of our grandfather's youth, I, too, had felt betrayed. My image of Oyango, faint as it was, had always been of an autocratic man, a cruel man, perhaps. But I had also imagined him an independent man, a man of his people, opposed to white rule. There was no real basis for this image. I now realized only the letter he had written to Gramps saying that he didn't want his son marrying white. That and his Muslim faith, which in my mind had become linked with the Nation of Islam back in the States. What Granny had told us scrambled that image completely, causing ugly words to flash across my mind. Uncle Tom, collaborator, house nigger. I tried to explain some of this to Granny, asking her if our grandfather had ever expressed his feelings about the white man. Just then, Saeed and Bernard emerged groggy-eyed from the house, and Zaituni directed them to the plates of food that had been set aside for them. It wasn't until they settled down to eat, and Alma and the neighbor's girl resumed their positions in front of the older women, that Granny returned to her story. I did not always understand what your grandfather thought. It was difficult because he did not like people to know him so well. Even when he spoke to you, he would look away for fear that you would know his thoughts. So it was with his attitude towards the white man. One day he would say one thing, and the next day it was as if he was saying something else. I know that he respected the white man for his power, for his machines and weapons, and the way he organized his life. He would say that the white man was always improving himself, whereas the African was suspicious of anything new. The African is thick, he would sometimes say to me. For him to do anything, he needs to be beaten. But despite these words, I don't think he ever believed that the white man was born superior to the African. In fact, he did not respect many of the white man's ways or their customs. He thought many things that they did were foolish or unjust. He himself, he would never allow himself to be beaten by a white man. This is how he lost many jobs. If the white man he worked for was abusive, he would tell the man to go to hell and leave to find other work. Once an employer tried to cane him, and your grandfather grabbed the man's cane and thrashed him with it. For this he was arrested, but when he explained what had happened, the authorities let him off with a fine and a warning. Is this, you all, did you hear any of this? Did I blank out for a minute and miss, did you all hear any of this?
No, it wasn't read.
Oh, okay.
I had that highlighted too. I didn't hear it though, but I thought maybe I missed it.
Okay. Last paragraph, I'll add this one. What your grandfather respected was strength, discipline. This is why, even though he learned many of the white man's ways, he always remained strict about Luo traditions. Respect for elders, respect for authority, order and custom in all his affairs. This is also why he rejected the Christian religion, I think. For a brief time, he converted and even changed his name to Johnson, but he could not understand such ideas as mercy to... Wait a minute. For a brief time, he converted and he even changed his name to Johnson, but he could not understand such ideas as mercy towards your enemies or that this man Jesus could wash away a man's sins. To your grandfather, this was foolish sentiment, something to comfort women, and so he converted to Islam. He thought its practices conformed more closely to his beliefs. I will stop there. That is monstrous. That is right at the section where the audio ended, and they apparently left all of that out of the audiobook. This is another one of those sections. Just reading it, it sounds very much like when he's talking about his grandfather's ambivalence, how he really felt about white people, and they say he's going back and forth. I think this is another section where he could be talking about himself. Even the part where he's thinking, dang, he's collaborating. He's the Uncle Tom house nigga part. I mean, that certainly would be applicable. I have heard President Obama referenced by those same titles. That is shameful that they left that out.
Especially with the, in reference to the religion, how he went, what he thought about Jesus and the foolishness with your enemy, to love your enemy, and all of this nonsense that are pushed as being the main force of your conversion, is that you have to learn to forgive your enemies. It was, you're right, they had to leave that part out.
And then where'd they come up with the name Johnson? Like, I don't know, like, wow.
You know, white people like naming people. They probably pulled it out the book, Andrew Johnson, and remember he was writing with Lincoln, with Liberia, and was repatriating black people to go back to Africa. Maybe that's where they came up with the name and said that might be a good name.
I just thought of how trifling and perverted white people are, because I seriously, when I heard Johnson, I thought of the sexual connotation. And yeah, I could see them doing that. Mandingo and all this stuff. They're so trifling.
But that's something that we came up with, that name, the name for Johnson's. That's not something that white people gave us. That's a name that between black folks that we came up with that name to reference the male private parts.
Oh, really? I didn't even know that.
Yes, it's black people. We're the one who came up with that name.
Wow, okay. You just educated me. I didn't know that.
It is, as you said, it is sympathy. The white woman is sympathy. She is the sympathetic object in this entire book. She is not. She's in essence rendered blameless. That's how it's coming off in this book. So that's why I know it was a female editor, a white female editor, who was in charge of chopping up this book and putting it together, because they put themselves in a very, very good light.
I think Granny is going to make one more, the white grandmother I'm talking about, I think she's going to make one more appearance in the last portion of the audiobook when he gets to the part about him and Michelle Obama when they're preparing for the marriage and everything. I think she does make one more appearance. I think the caller in Brooklyn, I thought that was a great catch as well. When he does the voices, I was telling Bruce Fine last week that he is killing me with these voices. When he was doing the black characters, and when he was just getting very animated when he was doing the characters that he met in Chicago, and you do not hear that when he does the voices for the white people. They sound like him. But when he does the voices for, even going back to his time in Hawaii, when he does the voices for the black people, it is, I would say, the same stereotypical voicing that you hear from white people, the way that they think of black people. I think that's pretty consistent in the book. You don't hear any sort of exaggeration like that when he does the voice for any of the white characters. At least I haven't heard it so far.
Yeah, my attempted brother over here said something that really resonated with me, and I had to laugh. He said that President Barack Obama, like, when he talks, he kind of, I mean, the problem is white people, you know, I don't want to, you know, But I mean, the way he talks, he sounds like he's impersonating himself, you know. And I guess it kind of maybe like speaks to that, you know, so-called double consciousness about just like being a successful, you know, person as a victim of white supremacy. You know, you kind of have to have a split personality, or you know, have some type of a boundaries in your head as to, I don't know. But yeah, I just found it interesting. He said that Obama sounds like he's impersonating himself when he talks. I just found that really funny for some reason.
He chooses his words very carefully to, compared to an average black person who would verbalize and just say what we might be on our mind. When he is speaking this, like, he is thinking ahead and choosing every word very carefully, keeping in mind that he don't want to offend white people. That is how he sounds, because he's very hesitant when he speaks. The average black person, when they speak, like myself, Gus, whoever, we just come right out and we just, our flow is very rapid. There's a lot of pausing when he speaks.
Can I hear you?
Trained lawyer. Yes, sir. The person 3358, we can hear you. And Praz, your line is open as well.
Yeah, this is the fellow. I have to agree with you when he does the so-called black characters. That was killing me when he was doing the brother from Chicago, the militant brother from Chicago, his character. You know, it's like to me, whenever I hear him do that character, it's like he's got this character. It's like a poor salesman, you know, uneducated salesman. I mean, he can't sound like Malcolm X, but he's got to sound like an uneducated, somebody trying to get over on you type of person when he does that. That's the vibe I get when he does that that character. And when you read the part here where talking about the grand, it was Barack's grandfather, I believe, right? One that didn't want to take Christianity, and something about changing his name to Johnson.
Right, correct.
Okay, now first thing that popped up in my head was the movie Shaka Zulu, when the Hollanders were trying to convince Shaka that Jesus was God of all God. And Shaka just made a real clear point that how can a man on a tree who can't even save himself be a God of be a stronger God than my God, or stronger than me, be a king of kings, that's what he said. You know, I'm not on a tree, basically what he's saying. You're trying to tell me that this person that's stuck to a tree is more powerful than me. And then he sent the white man to war for him. And he put the point across again. Now you went to war because of who? Who put you in war? Who put you in harm's way? Was it your Jesus or was it me? So who's got the power? And I thought it's the same kind of thing that he was saying to himself. It makes no sense to love thy enemy, because it's just confusion. And I can see him dealing with that same confusion, just like Shaka Zulu, like they were trying to push on the Shaka, but Shaka was smarter than that.
Can I be heard?
Is this Praz?
Yes.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I was looking on some of the like the Nigger Mania websites, and I was looking at his grandfather's name, which is, I believe, Onyango. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so I've noticed on the websites, the racist websites, they call Obama Obango, right? And then I just started looking at word associations and looking at, oh, Nyango is a grandfather's name, so they call Obama Obango. And then I was thinking of Sambo, and also Tarantino's new film that's coming out called Django, D-J-A-N-G-O. So it seems like there's no coincidence here because they paid careful attention to words. So I just found that those were some very interesting word connections.
Excellent. Excellent point. Glad you could share that. And that not only shows that you have the people that are on those sites, Nigger Mania and Chimp Out, I would say that, at least in my opinion, a lot of those folks, I would tend to classify them more in the Turner Diaries, less refined, racist white supremacists. That shows that even a significant, and I'm not all of them, I'm sure you have some refined racists who hang out on those sites too, but I would say generally that's more the Turner Diary style. That shows that even they apparently have read this book or have some familiarity with President Obama and family names or what have you, but I would suspect that some of them, they probably read this book.
Did they ever say where the name of Johnson, whose name was he trying to take or trying to mimic? What was he trying to do by changing his name to Johnson?
The portion of the book that I read that from, it didn't give any more information in terms of why Johnson was selected, who picked that, if it had any significance. It was just what I read. I don't know if it's in another portion of the book or maybe there's more detail, but I read what was there. They didn't provide any more info on that.
I just thought I missed some stuff. Is just okay.
You know what I know. You know what I know. I want to make sure we have time to chat on the second portion of the audio as well. Anybody have any final sentence they want to get in about the first chunk? Then we can get on to the second portion. Oh, everybody's good. All righty. We will do the second portion. It's about the same length as the first one. As I said, I think the white grandmother pops back in so we can all pay attention to the way he's describing her, the voices. I think this is the portion where he talks about how he and Michelle Obama got together. So that'll be interesting to hear descriptions of her as well. Last portion, we'll hit the phone lines once this concludes to wrap up. Be thinking of major themes you would take away from the book. Why white people are so enthralled, many of them, with this book. If you are a confused non-white person and you read this book, what you might take away from it, final impressions on the book, and how racist white supremacists have used the text and the audiobook. I would also keep in mind the text. I think that's what most people would get when they get this book. I don't think most people would get the audiobook. I think they would get the actual written text, which is not all redacted, so they would be getting, you know, everything. Be thinking, you know, what would be the purpose? How would putting this book out, the unedited form, putting it out, how would that aid the system of white supremacy? Why would it benefit them to have a book like this out for some non-white person that they intend to have in the White House? Keep that in mind. Final segment, President Barack Obama's Dreams from My Father.
I asked Granny if she had anything left of the old man's or our grandfather's. She went into her bedroom, sorting through the contents of an old leather trunk. A few minutes later, she emerged with a rust-colored book the size of a passport, along with a few papers of different colors, stapled together and chewed at an angle along one side. "I'm afraid this is all I could find," she said to Alma. "The rats got to the papers before I had a chance to put them away." Alma and I sat down and set the book and papers on the low table in front of us. The binding on the red book had crumbled away, but the cover was still legible. "Domestic Servants Pocket Register," it read. And in small letters, "Issued under the authority of the Registration of Domestic Servants Ordinance, 1928, Colony and Protectorate of Kenya. On the book's inside cover, we found a 2-shilling stamp above Onyango's left and right thumbprints. The swirls were still clear, like an imprint of coral. The box was empty, where the photograph once had been. The preamble explained, "The objective of this ordinance is to provide every person employed in a domestic capacity with a record of such employment, and to safeguard his or her interests, as well as to protect employers against the employment of persons who have rendered themselves unsuitable for such work." The term of servant was defined. Cook, house servant, waiter, butler, nurse, valet, barboy, footman, or chauffeur, or washerman. The rules governing the carrying of such passbooks. Servants found to be working without such books, or in any way injuring such books, are liable to a fine not exceeding 100 shillings, or to imprisonment not exceeding 6 months, or to both. And then, the particulars of said registered servant, filled out in the elegant, unhurried script of a nameless clerk. Name, Hussein Onyango. Native Registration Ordinance Number, RWLA, Nairobi, 0976717. Race or Tribe, Jaluo. Usual Place of Residence when Not Employed, Kisumu. Sex, Male. Age, 35. Height and Build, 6 foot, medium. Complexion, dark. Nose, flat. Mouth, large. Hair, curly. Teeth, 6 missing. Scars, tribal marks, or other peculiarities, none. Toward the back of the book, we found the particulars of employment signed and testified to by various employers. Captain C. Harford of Nairobi's Government House said that Onyango performed his duties as a personal boy with admirable diligence. Mr. A. G. Dixon found his cooking excellent. He can read and write English and follows any recipes. Apart from other things, his pastries are excellent. He no longer needed Onyango's services since, quote, "I'm no longer on safari." Dr. H. H. Sherry suggested that Onyango is a capable cook, but the job is not big enough for him. On the other hand, Mr. Arthur W. H. Cole of the East Africa Survey Group said that after a week on the job, Onyango was found to be unsuitable and certainly not worth 60 shillings per month. We moved to the stack of letters. They were from our father, addressed to various universities in the States. There were more than 30 of them, to the presidents of Morgan State, Santa Barbara Junior College, San Francisco State. "Dear President Calhoun," one letter began, "I have heard of your college from Mrs. Helen Roberts of Palo Alto, California, who is now in Nairobi here. Mrs. Roberts, knowing how much desirous I am to further my studies in the United States of America, has asked me to apply to your esteemed college for admission. I shall therefore be very much pleased if you will kindly forward to me your application form and information regarding the possibility of such scholarships as you may be aware of." Attached to several letters were recommendations from Miss Elizabeth Mooney, a literacy specialist from Maryland. "It is not possible to obtain Mr. Obama's school transcripts," she wrote, "since he has been out of school for some years." However, Miss Mooney expressed confidence in our father's talents, noting that she had observed him making use of algebra and geometry. She added that there was a great need in Kenya for capable and dedicated teachers, and that, given Mr. Obama's desire to be of service to his country, he should be given a chance, perhaps on a one-year basis. This was it, I thought to myself. My inheritance. I rearranged the letters in a neat stack and set them under the registry book. Then I went out into the backyard. Standing before the two graves, I felt everything around me, the cornfields, the mango tree, the sky, closing in, until I was left only with a series of mental images, Granny's stories come to life. I see my grandfather, standing before his father's hut, a wiry, grim-faced boy, almost ridiculous in his oversized trousers and his buttonless shirt. I watch his father turn away from him and hear his brother's laugh. I feel the heat pour down his brow, the knots forming in his limbs, the sudden jump in his heart. And as his figure turns and starts back down the road of red earth, I know that for him the path of his life is now altered irreversibly, completely. He will have to reinvent himself in this arid, solitary place. Through force of will, he will create a life out of the scraps of an unknown world, and the memories of a world rendered obsolete. And yet, as he sits alone in a freshly scrubbed hut, an old man now with milky eyes, I know that he still hears his father and brothers laughing behind him. He still hears the clipped voice of a British captain, explaining for the third and last time the correct proportion of tonic to gin. The nerves of the old man's neck tighten. The rage builds. He grabs a stick to hit at something, anything, until finally his grip weakens with the realization that for all the power in his hands and the force of his will, the laughter, the rebukes will outlast him. His body goes slack in the chair. He knows he will not outlive a mocking fate. He waits to die alone. The picture fades, replaced by the image of a 9-year-old boy, my father. He's hungry, tired, clinging to his sister's hand, searching for the mother he's lost. The hunger is too much for him, the exhaustion too great, until finally the slender line that holds him to his mother snaps, sending her image to float down, down into the emptiness. The boy starts to cry. He shakes off his sister's hand. He wants to go home, he shouts, back to his father's house. He will find a new mother. He will lose himself in games and learn the power of his mind. But he won't forget the desperation of that day. 12 years later, at his narrow desk, he will glance up from a stack of forms toward the restless sky and feel that same panic return. He too will have to invent himself. His boss is out of the office. He sets the forms aside and from an old file cabinet pulls out a list of addresses. He yanks the typewriter toward him and begins to type, letter after letter after letter, typing the envelopes, sealing the letters like messages in bottles that will drop through a post office slot into a vast ocean and perhaps allow him to escape the island of his father's shame. How lucky he must have felt when his ship came sailing in. He must have known, when that letter came from Hawaii, that he had been chosen after all, that he possessed the grace of his name, the baraka, the blessings of God. With the degree, the ascot, the American wife, the car, the words, the figures, the wallet, the proper proportion of tonic to gin, the polish, the panache, the entire thing seamless and natural, without the cobbled-together, haphazard quality of an earlier time, what could stand in his way? He had almost succeeded, in a way his own father could never have hoped for. And then, after seeming to travel so far, to discover that he had not escaped after all, to discover that he remained trapped on his father's island, with its fissures of anger and doubt and defeat, the emotions still visible beneath the surface, hot and molten and alive, like a wicked, yawning mouth, and his mother gone, gone away. I dropped to the ground and swept my hand across the smooth yellow tile. "Oh, Father," I cried, "there was no shame in your confusion, just as there had been no shame in your father's before you, no shame in the fear or in the fear of his father before him. There was only shame in the silence fear had produced. It was the silence that betrayed us. If it weren't for that silence, your grandfather might have told your father that he could never escape himself or recreate himself alone. Your father might have taught those same lessons to you. And you, the son, might have taught your father that this new world that was beckoning all of you involved more than just railroads and indoor toilets and irrigation ditches and gramophones, lifeless instruments that could be absorbed into the old ways. You might have told him that these instruments carried with them a dangerous power, that they demanded a different way of seeing the world, that this power could be absorbed only alongside a faith born out of hardship, a faith that wasn't new, that wasn't black or white or Christian or Muslim, but that pulsed in the heart of the first African village and the first Kansas homestead, a faith in other people. The silence killed your faith, and for lack of faith you clung to both too much and too little of your past. Too much of its rigidness, its suspicions, its male cruelties. Too little of the laughter in Granny's voice, the pleasures of company while herding the goats, the murmur of the market, the stories around the fire, the loyalty that could make up for a lack of airplanes or rifles, words of encouragement, an embrace, a strong, true love. For all your gifts, the quick mind, the powers of concentration, the charm, You can never forge yourself into a whole man by leaving those things behind. For a long time, I sat between the two graves and wept. When my tears were finally spent, I felt a calmness wash over me. I felt the circle finally close. I realized that who I was, what I cared about, was no longer just a matter of intellect or obligation, no longer a construct of words. I saw that my life in America, the black life, the white life, the sense of abandonment I'd felt as a boy, the frustration and hope I had witnessed in Chicago, all of it was connected with this small plot of earth an ocean away, connected by more than the accident of a name or the color of my skin. The pain I felt was my father's pain. My questions were my brother's questions. Their struggle, my birthright. A light rain began to fall, the drops tapping on the leaves above. I was about to light a cigarette when I felt a hand on my arm. I turned to find Bernard squatting beside me, trying to fit the two of us under a bent-up old umbrella. "They wanted me to see if you were okay," he said. I smiled. "Yeah, I'm okay." He nodded, his eyes squinting at the clouds. He turned back to me and said, "Why don't you let me have a cigarette, and I will sit and smoke with you?" I looked at his smooth, dark face and put the cigarette back in the box. "I need to quit," I said. "Come on, let's take a walk instead." We stood up and started towards the entrance to the compound. The young boy, Godfrey, was standing beside the cooking hut, one leg propped like a crane's against the mud wall. He looked at us and offered a tentative smile. "Come on," Bernard said, waving to the boy. "You can walk with us." And so the three of us made our way over the widening dirt road, picking at leaves that grew along the way, watching the rain blow down across the several valleys. Epilogue. I think I've learned to be more patient these past few years, with others as well as myself. If so, it's one of the several improvements in my character that I attribute to my wife, Michelle. She's a daughter of the South Side, raised in one of those bungalow-style houses that I spent so many hours visiting during my first year in Chicago. She doesn't always know what to make of me. She worries that, like Gramps and the old man, I'm something of a dreamer. Indeed, in her eminent practicality and Midwestern attitudes, she reminds me not a little of Toot. I remember how, the first time I took her back to Hawaii, Gramps nudged my ribs and said Michelle was quite a looker. Toot, on the other hand, described my bride-to-be as a very sensible girl, which Michelle understood to be my grandmother's highest form of praise. After our engagement, I took Michelle to Kenya to meet the other half of my family. She was an immediate success there as well, in part because the number of Luo words in her vocabulary very soon surpassed my own. We had a fine time in Alego, helping Alma on a film project of hers, listening to more of Granny's stories, meeting relatives I'd missed the first time around. Away from the countryside, though, life in Kenya seemed to have gotten harder. The economy had worsened, with a corresponding rise in corruption and street crime. The case of the old man's inheritance remained unresolved, and Sarah and Kazia were still not on speaking terms. Neither Bernard or Abo or Said had yet found steady work, although they remained hopeful. They were talking about learning how to drive, perhaps purchasing a used matatu together. There were deaths that year. Michelle's father, as good and decent a man as I've ever known, died before he could give his daughter away. Gramps died a few months later, after a prolonged bout with prostate cancer. Despite these heartaches, Michelle and I decided to go ahead with our wedding plans. Reverend Jeremiah A. Wright, Jr. performed the service in the sanctuary of Trinity United Church of Christ on 95th and Parnell. Everyone looked very fine at my reception, my new aunts admiring the cake, my new uncles admiring themselves in their rented tuxedos. I watched Maya, politely fending off the advances of some brothers who thought they were slick but who were, in fact, much too old for and should have known better. But when I started to grumble, Michelle told me to relax. My little sister could handle herself. Michelle was right, of course. I looked at my baby sister and saw a full-grown woman now, beautiful and wise and looking like a Latin countess with her olive skin and long black hair and black bridesmaid's gown. Aoma was standing beside her, looking just as lovely, although her eyes were a little puffy. To my surprise, she was the only one who cried during the ceremony. When the band started to play, the two of them sought out the protection of Michelle's 5 and 6-year-old cousins, who impressively served as our official ring bearers. Watching the boys somberly lead my sisters out onto the dance floor, I thought they looked like young African princes in their little kente cloth caps and matching cummerbunds and wilted bow ties. The person who made me proudest of all, though, was Roy. Actually, now we call him Abongo, his Luo name, for 2 years ago he decided to reassert his African heritage. He converted to Islam and has sworn off pork and tobacco and alcohol. He still works at his accounting firm, but talks about moving back to Kenya once he has enough money. In fact, when we saw each other in Home Squared, he was busy building a hut for himself and his mother, away from our grandfather's compound, in accordance with Luo tradition. Abongo's new lifestyle has left him lean and clear-eyed, and at the wedding he looked so dignified in his black African gown with white trim and matching cap that some of our guests mistook him for my father. He was certainly the older brother that day, talking me through prenuptial jitters, patiently telling me for the 5th and 6th time that yes, he still had the ring, nudging me out the door with the observation that if I spent any more time in front of the mirror, it wouldn't matter how I looked because we were sure to be late. Toward the end of the wedding, I watched him grinning widely for the video camera, his long arms draped over the shoulders of my mother and Toot, whose heads barely reached the height of his chest. "Hey, brother," he said to me as I walked up to the three of them. "It looks like I have 2 new mothers now." Toot patted him on the back. "And we have a new son," she said, although when she tried to say Abongo, her Kansas tongue mangled it hopelessly. My mother's chin started to tremble again, and Abongo lifted up his glass of fruit punch for a toast. "To those who are not here with us," he said. "And to a happy ending," I said. We dribbled our drinks onto the checker-tiled floor, and for that moment at least, I felt like the luckiest man alive.
The next senator from the state of Illinois, Barack Obama. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Dick Durbin. You make us all proud. On behalf of the great state of Illinois, crossroads of a nation, land of Lincoln, let me express my deepest gratitude for the privilege of addressing this convention. Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook, a domestic servant to the British. But my grandfather had larger dreams for his son. Through hard work and perseverance, my father got a scholarship to study in a magical place, America, that shone as a beacon of freedom and opportunity to so many who had come before. While studying here, my father met my mother. She was born in a town on the other side of the world, in Kansas. Her father worked on oil rigs and farms through most of the Depression. The day after Pearl Harbor, my grandfather signed up for duty, joined Patton's army, marched across Europe. Back home, my grandmother raised a baby and went to work on a bomber assembly line. After the war, they studied on the GI Bill, bought a house through FHA, and later moved west, all the way to Hawaii, in search of opportunity. And they, too, had big dreams for their daughter. A common dream born of two continents. My parents shared not only an improbable love, they shared an abiding faith in the possibilities of this nation. They would give me an African name, Barak, or Blessed, believing that in a tolerant America, your name is no barrier to success. They imagined me going to the best schools in the land, even though they weren't rich, because in a generous America, you don't have to be rich to achieve your potential. They're both passed away now. And yet I know that on this night, they look down on me with great pride. They stand here, and I stand here today, grateful for the diversity of my heritage, aware that my parents' dreams live on in my two precious daughters. I stand here knowing that my story is part of the larger American story, that I owe a debt to all of those who came before me, and that in no other country on earth is my story even possible. Tonight, we gather to affirm the greatness of our nation. Not because of the height of our skyscrapers, or the power of our military, or the size of our economy. Our pride is based on a very simple premise, summed up in a declaration made over 200 years ago. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That is the true genius of America. A faith in simple dreams, an insistence on small miracles, that we can tuck in our children at night and know that they are fed and clothed and safe from harm. That we can say what we think, write what we think, without hearing a sudden knock on the door. That we can have an idea and start our own business without paying a bribe. That we can participate in the political process without fear of retribution, and that our votes will be counted, at least most of the time. This year, in this election, we are called to reaffirm our values and our commitments, to hold them against a hard reality, and see how we're measuring up to the legacy of our forebears and the promise of future generations. And fellow Americans, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, I say to you tonight, we have more work to do. More work to do for the workers I met in Galesburg, Illinois, who are losing their union jobs at the Maytag plant that's moving to Mexico, and now are having to compete with their own children for jobs that pay $7 an hour. More to do for the father that I met who was losing his job and choking back the tears, wondering how he would pay $4,500 a month for the drugs his son needs without the health benefits that he counted on. More to do for the young woman in East St. Louis, and thousands more like her, who has the grades, has the drive, has the will, but doesn't have the money to go to college. Now, don't get me wrong. The people I meet in small towns and big cities, in diners and office parks, they don't expect government to solve all their problems. They know they have to work hard to get ahead, and they want to. Go into the collar counties around Chicago, and people will tell you they don't want their tax money wasted by a welfare agency or by the Pentagon. Go into any inner city neighborhood, and folks will tell you that government alone can't teach our kids to learn. They know that parents have to teach, that children can't achieve unless we raise their expectations and turn off the television sets and eradicate the slander that says a black youth with a book is acting white. They know those things. People don't expect government to solve all their problems. But they sense deep in their bones that with just a slight change in priorities, we can make sure that every child in America has a decent shot at life and that the doors of opportunity remain open to all. They know we can do better, and they want that choice. In this election, we offer that choice. Our party has chosen a man to lead us who embodies the best this country has to offer. And that man is John Kerry. John Kerry understands the ideals of community, faith, and service because they've defined his life. From his heroic service to Vietnam, to his years as a prosecutor and lieutenant governor, through 2 decades in the United States Senate, he's devoted himself to this country. Again and again, we've seen him make tough choices when easier ones were available. His values and his record affirm what is best in us. John Kerry believes in an America where hard work is rewarded. So instead of offering tax breaks to companies shipping jobs overseas, he offers them to companies creating jobs here at home. John Kerry believes in an America where all Americans can afford the same health coverage our politicians in Washington have for themselves. John Kerry believes in energy independence, so we aren't held hostage to the profits of oil companies or the sabotage of foreign oil fields. John Kerry believes in the constitutional freedoms that have made our country the envy of the world, and he will never sacrifice our basic liberties, nor use faith as a wedge to divide us. And John Kerry believes that in a dangerous world, war must be an option sometimes, but it should never be the first option. You know, a while back, I met a young man named Seamus in a VFW hall in East Moline, Illinois. He was a good-looking kid, 6'2", 6'3", clear-eyed, with an easy smile. He told me he joined the Marines and was heading to Iraq the following week. And as I listened to him explain why he'd enlisted, the absolute faith he had in our country and its leaders, his devotion to duty and service, I thought, this young man was all that any of us might ever hope for in a child. But then I asked myself, are we serving Seamus as well as he's serving us? I thought of the 900 men and women, sons and daughters, husbands and wives, friends and neighbors who won't be returning to their own hometowns. I thought of the families I've met who were struggling to get by without a loved one's full income, or whose loved ones had returned with a limb missing or nerves shattered, but still lack long-term health benefits because they were reservists. When we send our young men and women into harm's way, we have a solemn obligation not to fudge the numbers or shade the truth about why they are going, to care for their families while they're gone, to tend to the soldiers upon their return, and to never, ever go to war without enough troops to win the war, secure the peace, and earn the respect of the world. Now, let me be clear. We have real enemies in the world. These enemies must be found, they must be pursued, and they must be defeated. John Kerry knows this. And just as Lieutenant Kerry did not hesitate to risk his life to protect the men who served with him in Vietnam, President Kerry will not hesitate one moment to use our military might to keep America safe and secure. John Kerry believes in America. And he knows that it's not enough for just some of us to prosper. For alongside our famous individualism, there's another ingredient in the American saga. a belief that we're all connected as one people. If there is a child on the south side of Chicago who can't read, that matters to me even if it's not my child. If there's a senior citizen somewhere who can't pay for their prescription drugs and having to choose between medicine and the rent, that makes my life poorer even if it's not my grandparent. If there's an Arab American family being rounded up without benefit of an attorney or due process, that threatens my civil liberties. It is that fundamental belief. It is that fundamental belief, I am my brother's keeper, I am my sister's keeper, that makes this country work. It's what allows us to pursue our individual dreams and yet still come together as one American family. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Now, even as we speak, there are those who are preparing to divide us, the spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America. The pundits like to slice and dice our country into red states and blue states. Red states for Republicans, blue states for Democrats. But I've got news for them, too. We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states. We coach Little League in the blue states, and yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states. There are patriots who oppose the war in Iraq, and they're patriots who supported the war in Iraq. We are one people, all of us pledging allegiance to the Stars and Stripes, all of us defending the United States of America. In the end, that's what this election is about. Do we participate in a politics of cynicism, or do we participate in a politics of hope? John Kerry calls on us to hope. John Edwards calls on us to hope. I'm not talking about blind optimism here, the almost willful ignorance that thinks unemployment will go away if we just don't think about it, or healthcare crisis will solve itself if we just ignore it. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something more substantial. It's the hope of slaves sitting around a fire singing freedom songs. The hope of immigrants setting out for distant shores. The hope of a young naval lieutenant bravely patrolling the Mekong Delta. The hope of a mill worker's son who dares to defy the odds. The hope of a skinny kid with a funny name who believes that America has a place for him too. In the face of difficulty, hope in the face of uncertainty, the audacity of hope. In the end, that is God's greatest gift to us, the bedrock of this nation, a belief in things not seen, a belief that there are better days ahead. I believe that we can give our middle class relief and provide working families with a road to opportunity. I believe we can provide jobs to the jobless, homes to the homeless, and reclaim young people in cities across America from violence and despair. I believe that we have a righteous wind at our backs, and that as we stand on the crossroads of history, we can make the right choices and meet the challenges that face us. America, tonight, if you feel the same energy that I do, if you feel the same urgency that I do, if you feel the same passion that I do, if you feel the same hopefulness that I do, if we do what we must do, then I have no doubt that all across the country, from Florida to Oregon, from Washington to Maine, the people will rise up in November, and John Kerry will be sworn in as president, and John Edwards will be sworn in as vice president, and this country will reclaim its promise and out of this long political darkness, a brighter day will come. Thank you very much, everybody. God bless you. Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed this production of Dreams from My Father, A Story of Race and Inheritance by Barack Obama. This program was produced by Jacob Bronstein and directed by Jacob Bronstein and Brian Smith. Text copyright 1995-2004 by Barack Obama. Production copyright 2005, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Context of white supremacy.
Woo!
The number to dial, 760-569-7676, and the code 564-943-POUND. Do not wait until the last minute. Go ahead and get your hand up if you would like to participate. We've got about a half hour, ample time. Do not wait until the last 5 minutes to decide that you would like to share. I will mute my line. I just want to get this in. Again, they omitted a lot from even the epilogue. I'm just going to read these three paragraphs from the epilogue, and then the folks that are on the line, you can share. If any new hands are up, I'll add those as well. Some of this should sound very familiar. We hold these truths to be self-evident. In those words, I hear the spirit of Douglas and Delaney, as well as Jefferson and Lincoln, the struggles of Martin and Malcolm, and unheralded marchers to bring these words to life. I hear the voices of Japanese families interned behind barbed wire, young Russian Jews cutting patterns in Lower East Side sweatshops, Dust Bowl farmers loading up their trucks with the remains of shattered lives. I hear the voices of the people in Altyell Gardens and the voices of those who stand outside this country's borders, the weary, hungry bands crossing the Rio Grande. I hear all these voices clamoring for recognition, all of them asking the very same questions that have come to shape my life. The same questions that I sometimes, late at night, find myself asking the old man. What is our community, and how might that community be reconciled with our freedom? How far do our obligations reach? How do we transform mere power into justice, mere sentiment into love? The answers I find in law books don't always satisfy me. For every Brown vs. Board of Education, I find a score of cases where conscience is sacrificed to expedience or greed. And yet in the conversation itself, in the joining of voices, I find myself modestly encouraged, believing that so long as the questions are still being asked, what binds us together might somehow ultimately prevail. That faith, so different from innocence, can sometimes be hard to sustain. Upon my return to Chicago, I would find the signs of decay accelerated throughout the South Side, the neighborhoods shabbier, the children edgier and less restrained, more middle-class families headed out to the suburbs, the jails bursting with glowering youth, my brothers without prospects. All too rarely do I hear people asking just what it is that we've done to make so many children's hearts so hard, or what collectively we might do to right their moral compass, what values we must live by instead. I see us doing what we've always done, pretending that these children are somehow not our own. I try to do my small part in reversing this tide. In my legal practice, I work mostly with churches and community groups, men and women who quietly build grocery stores and health clinics in the inner city and housing for the poor. Every so often, I find myself working on a discrimination case, representing clients who show up at my law firm's office with stories that we like to tell ourselves should no longer exist. Most of these clients are slightly embarrassed by what's happened to them, as are the white coworkers who agreed to testify on their behalf. No one wants to be known as a troublemaker. And yet, at some point, both plaintiff and witness, this principle is at stake. That despite everything that has happened, those words put to paper over 200 years ago must mean something after all. Black and white, they make their claim on this community we call America. They choose our better history. I will stop there. The lines from the folks who had dialed in before, you're open. S. Dot, your line will be open as well, and we had one other caller.
Okay, Gus, I'm going to say this. I have to get offline real quickly. Hello?
Yes, ma'am, we can hear you.
Oh, okay. To go back to the beginning of the book, the part that you were reading when they went to get the effects of their grandfather, the president and his sister, and they got his employment handbook, and it made me, I don't even want to use the word cringe, when they were reading off his book, it sounds like something from a slave narrative, how you describe property that you are selling. That's how they made the man sound. Nose big, mouth big, missing six teeth. And it was like, what? It was just awful. And this book, I don't know in case if the readers were not aware, this book won a Grammy Award, was given to this book. So we can understand why this book was given so much accolades and why it was moved along as it did. Because the so-called entertainment industry, they had a hand in crafting this book, in making it as fictionalized as possible, trying to throw in a few things. Because from what I've understood and what from people that I've talked to that were in the Chicago area, This whole thing with him as the organizer and all of this stuff that we have been fed and given, it's not even fit, if it's not even a part of the description. But this was all something that was created, just like this thing with Abraham Lincoln and this movie and all of this madness that's pushed out here, where people are running out here to go see this fiction. This is what has been crafted and given to us, this fiction. Because this whole thing, I'm right back to where I started off before, where I said that white people, women in particular, have been giving the essence of coming off as saintly in this narrative, while black people, the men as well as the women, we are treated shabbily in this book, very, very shabbily. Our description, our tone of voice, everything about us is treated in a very rough way. And it seems that even his relationship with his brothers, his two brothers that he had with Ruth, his father had with Ruth, they don't have a relationship. That's how the white woman just came into this picture and made sure that she separated her children from his other relatives, because he don't have that relationship. I don't believe that they have communicated or they have been in touch with each other, his other two brothers, Mark and whatever the other brother, I think it's David was the other brother's name that he had with his Ruth. So we're seeing this connect with white women, where they have always sought to separate the black people, basically cut you off from any kind of support system. You're supposed to be out there with them in this canoe, just sink or swim, and they just don't want you to have any connection to do with your black side.
That's it for me for right now, because it just really, really troubled me when I was reading out that, when he was reading out his employer handbook for his grandfather, how disgusted I felt.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
You know, I listened to the very end when they gave credits to the producers of the audiobook, Jacob Bronstein and Brian Smith. And interestingly, when you Google them, you cannot find anything about them at all. It only reflects you to the fact that they produced the audiobook. So there's no way to find anything about these guys. And, you know, I don't know if that was scrubbed from the internet or, you know, it's just interesting that you're not able to find anything about them. So I just wanted to comment on that.
Best-selling book. That is very suspicious. I'll mute my line.
To kind of go off 404, I also noted about how the grandfather in their description of him basically sounded like Chateau, like property. But then I also took note of, I believe it was President Obama's father, how they were saying he had the degree, car, American, which means white, white wife, and basically they felt like with these tools of success, he felt like he escaped, but then he realized he was still on his father's land, or however they put it, and it just brought me back to earlier in the book about the suits again, and it's no matter how much you have or what you achieve, you still haven't escaped the system of racism, white supremacy. And then I also noted how he was saying their struggle was his birthright. So basically, he is, you know, basically he's the product of a tragic arrangement. So he's non-white with the white parent, and he's got to say that what he got from the non-white side is the struggle. So I noted that.
Really briefly, I wanted to say to 404, it's been a minute since I've heard you, so I'm glad that I'm hearing you tonight, so welcome back.
Thank you. What B. Moore was just said with the narrative with the father and how it does not set right with me. This last part of this book, it just really, really does not set right with me. And as the caller said, with these two persons whose names sound of European Jewish extraction, industry could be some pseudonym that they put together to cover up their identity, that put this stuff together, which is why I said this is sound very scripted. This is very Hollywoodish that was put together. Because I believe he said this book, the audio portion was done in 2004, and this was right up leading up to the Kerry, if I'm not mistaken, when they had the DNC convention, when he was so-called made, came on the national scene. So this is very Hollywoodish, very scripted.
This is 1804, very scripted, and as I said last week, it's like the perfect tale to appeal. It's got something for everybody. It seems crafted. I mean, and I'm talking from the very first script of the book.
Doesn't the original copyright say 1995? So the audio version was recorded in 2004, 9 years later. Is that correct?
Correct.
That's what I heard.
And this recording did garner a Grammy, right?
Doc, can you speak up, please? Thank you.
I'm sorry, I'm working outside. And this recording did get a Grammy, right?
Yes.
Okay. And coincidentally, he's also received the Nobel Peace Prize. Seems like a very coordinated effort to me.
Very coordinated and very focus grouped. You know, I mean, some of my friends who worked in marketing at the time I was very pro-Obama. I bought the whole thing, hook, line, and sinker in 08. And some of my friends who worked in marketing then were like, you'll understand with time this is a marketing concoction. And it took me, you know, less than 4 years to get it.
Makes me even kind of wonder that when John Kerry and what was the vice president, or the guy running for vice president?
Edwards.
When he got hemmed up with the other woman, that just seemed to be so convenient. That could have all been scripted in order for Bush and his cohorts to continue on. I wouldn't even put it. Yeah, I would say everything was that the horse, or should I say the race was thrown, so that it paved the way for Barack Obama.
It's just like this re-election also was scripted. It was a thrown race, because when Romney came into the play, when he was pushed to the forefront as going to be the finalist, and when he decided to choose this Ryan person from Wisconsin to be his running mate, I said he's the president has already won re-election. I said this has just been thrown out here, because the two worst candidates they put up there for the opposition front runner to throw the whole race, so he could have a legit reason to say, okay, you're picking the better of two evils, so we can't afford to have these two demons get come in and just upset the apple cart. So it was thrown. I knew it from the beginning. I said, it's a done deal.
Yeah, I felt the same way too. And this is a time of maximum military aggression on behalf of this country, especially in black countries like Haiti and the Congo. And I always thought, there's no way you're going to get a Mitt Romney heading, you know, being the face of that military aggression. For it to be swallowed whole, it has to be Obama. And indeed, people in those countries tend to, you know, are kind of asleep to the reality that this is basically the very person who's going to sign their death sentence. I mean, not personally, but it's going to be done in his name and with his face. And I, you know, God knows what happens to him after they've done the dirty work, thanks to people like him, Susan Rice, etc.
Exactly.
Well, I would say that the whole AFRICOM initiative would not be able to go forth had it not been for a non-white person to be in the most visible position. So all of this smokescreen about Benghazi and all of that, that's really just a bunch of chatter so that these folks can go in full force with their guns blazing down the road, because they have to bring order to a disordered, uncivilized nation, so to speak. So I think that I really feel sad for him as an individual, because I think that he at some point legitimately had a sincere desire to make a difference or to impact the situation. But I think, like many victims who don't recognize the scope of what exactly is going on, once he found himself in the position that he's in, he recognizes that his family is in harm's way. He is in harm's way 24 hours a day, and it's going to get a lot worse.
Exactly. That was
Hello,
why.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
All right, am I loud enough?
You're good.
Yeah.
yeah, I just wanted to provide some pushback to what some of the callers on the line have said. I wanted to ask, doesn't the view that that this whole thing that you know, with the book, with Obama's presidency, that, you know, saying that it was all scripted, doesn't that support, further support the system of white supremacy?
Yes.
Probably.
How?
Well,
we're
no,
just saying, well,
I actually don't think so.
I feel that we may be just acknowledging it of how, you know, how good they are.
Exactly.
How would saying that you suspect President Obama, him being in the White House, this book, his speech at the 2004 Democratic National Convention, how would saying that you suspect that that was scripted by racist white supremacists, how would that support the system?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Can you say just that one more time, please? Just repeat it one more time.
Yes, sir. I thought your question, you said, doesn't making the statement or just putting it out there that you think this was scripted, doesn't that support the system of white supremacy? Was that your question?
Right, that was the question, yes.
Okay. And I was asking, how would that support the system of white supremacy?
Okay, I guess the point I was trying to make is, by saying that, you basically saying that, you know, that this guy didn't do any of this thing. You know what I'm saying? That's like what white supremacists do, like to say that, you know, black people can't amount to anything, and that everything, you know, they're dumb and stupid and all of that. You know what I'm saying? So doesn't that a further contribute to that when you say that, you know, well, not you, but when some, when people say that, you know, that, you know, it's all scripted, because I'm not willing to buy all of that. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure I buy that way of thinking. I just don't.
Can I ask you a question? Would you say that it supports the system of white supremacy to say that Condoleezza Rice was scripted? Or would that just be an obvious observation?
To say that Condoleezza Rice was scripted? Would it support it?
Would it? I mean, a lot of people say that Clarence Thomas and Condoleezza Rice are scripted, right? That they are basically puppets. Do you support the system of white supremacy when you say they're puppets?
It's very difficult to hear you. I think your handle is 1804. That background noise is it's very difficult for me to hear you correctly. Can anybody else repeat the question she asked?
I'm sure you can hear me a little better now because I stepped away. Does it support the system of white supremacy to say that Condoleezza Rice and Clarence Thomas were puppets?
I don't think they are puppets.
Let me ask a question. Do you think it is possible, if you had access to infinite amount of cash, to create a person from when they go to high school? Like how Nike does basketball players. Do you think it's possible for people that are in this political game that run this country, do you think it's possible for them to build up and put a face on things? And do you think it's possible to have more than one Barack Obama just in case he didn't show up to the game?
There could be a possibility, but that doesn't mean that it will be successful. I mean, there's a lot of variables in life, you know what I'm saying? Accidents can happen, and
exactly, that's why
happen,
I said,
you know.
That's why I said, do you think it's possible to have more than one have all your ducks lined up in a row like Nike does.
I don't think you can have another Obama. I mean, everybody is different. You know, not everybody has the same personality as Barack Obama. That's like saying there's millions of other people, like, you know, not millions, but that's like saying there's like 10 other people like you who have the same personality as you.
You do not think that Nike can produce basketball players, because Nike has produced a lot of basketball players.
They can. But
so if you can do basketball players,
it's going to be a superstar. You know what I'm saying?
So then how could it be that hard for them to do the same thing to gifted, black, young, educated people? All of a sudden, they get a boost from somewhere. All of a sudden, they think they're doing all this by themselves, and then you get a helping hand here, a helping hand there. Next thing you know, you got Rockefeller in your background. You got Rockefeller in your pocket. He's backing you. Next thing you know, everybody else is backing you. You don't think that's possible?
I'm all for getting help wherever you can get it from. You know, so if someone has the talent,
exactly. Like everybody that's economically challenged, right? You offer help wherever it comes from, without really thinking about where it's coming from and where is it leading you until you get there. And that's the disadvantage that I see that black people around the world have, including in Kenya, where he was talking about his own family. Remember, his own father having problems with the government that they were dealing with. You see, when money plays it, when they have you at a disadvantage, bad decisions can happen real easy, but a lot of things can be relieved out of your way when I'm just saying a lot of obstacles can be taken right out of your way when you got money backing you.
Exactly, and to touch on what the caller just said, we only have to look at the president met for dinner with Mitt Romney either yesterday or today privately in the family dining room in their living quarters at the White House. So cameras were off limits, reporters were off limits to what they discussed. So you want to tell me that this has never happened before in any presidential election where, as nasty as this was, where the loser was invited to the White House for a sit-down dinner off the record for them to go over notes. So you want to tell me that this is not something else is being done here? You know, we are naive, and we were born last night. We were born yesterday, but I didn't fall off the back of a turnip truck.
Okay. Didn't Lincoln have team of rivals in his cabinet as well? I mean,
how about that?
I just wanted to say one thing real quick when you were talking about Lincoln, because they do make a lot of comparisons between former President Lincoln, President Obama, and I think this just goes to my whole stance on all of this. I have concluded we are in a system of white supremacy. That means white people are in charge. The clip that I have on YouTube where Minister Farrakhan says, you know, I'm happy about President Obama being there, but I never forget this is the White House, and I understand who is in charge of the White House, and that's something that we, black people, should not forget. I started this program, the audio clip, Neely Fuller Jr., where he said, I asked him, with President Obama being the White House, if white people didn't want him to be there, and he said, any black person who forgets that is forgetting a very important fundamental. If we are in a system of white supremacy, if that is the dominant force on this planet, there is no way a non-white person, even a non-white person with a white parent, would be in the White House if white people, particularly the most powerful white people, didn't sign off on that. If they didn't want him to be there, I don't believe he would be there. And I don't think that that's taking away agency from non-white people, even President Obama. It's just making sure that I remember the system of white supremacy is still in effect, and it would be very easy if they didn't want him to be there, he would not have that seat. In fact, if they didn't want him to have that seat tomorrow, he would be gone. Either that's true or it's not. But that viewpoint is anchored to the fact that the system of white supremacy is still in effect. And I think President Obama's book, he's pointing to that consistently, that system being in effect, the power that white people have. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on that because I think that's just one either, you know, either the system exists or it doesn't. If it does, you know, I think it's self-explanatory. If you don't think that's the case, then that's kind of, in my view, that's kind of invalidating the system of white supremacy and how much power white people have. At any rate, since we are closing on the end, are there any final thoughts folks want to get in on the book, takeaway points, things that stood out, patterns, why you think white people adore this book so much? Anything folks want to get in before we conclude?
I would like to add just something just real quick on everyone's comments. I want to go back to Neely Fuller's definition of a monster and or monstrosity. And I think the whole point of that is like a monstrosity, I mean, would be any white person. I mean, I'm sorry, any non-white person who it may seem like they're fighting against a system of racism, white supremacy, but they're actually supporting it. And I think that, you know, I definitely know that probably include myself and many other non-white people. And I think that's what makes it difficult for us because we try to fight against it, but in a sense, we can't help but to support it. So, I mean, I guess it's a matter of minimizing the support of the system. I don't think we can totally not support it. I don't think we're at a position yet where we have any kind of pull. But I think that, you know, Obama, under the definition of a monstrosity, he would be as the majority or all of the non-white people, as, you know, if we agree that we're living in a system of racism, white supremacy. And that's all I want to add.
I couldn't get a point in, but I wanted to agree with Gus. As victims under the system of white supremacy, we are pretty much all puppets in some way. But I was also going to say that the book, it didn't necessarily make me look at President Obama any differently. There were a lot of points where I felt like he was less confused than I initially thought, but he's still a victim under the system of white supremacy, so I don't necessarily see him as different. And I feel like white people, they gave him so much accolades over the book because, in a sense, just the way he portrays them, like, I don't know, like, they look good in the book. So I feel like that's why they would support it and things like that. And also, even the audio, the abridged or whatever you call it, because of the part they left out. They left out in key parts, important parts, and I feel like that's why they would support it.
I think they would support it because black people are made to believe it. Everything is their fault. They're in the position because not because of white colonialism, but it's because of their own ignorance and their own hatred. They have a hatred that's there that wasn't put there by white people. That's what I think that the reason why they're cool with the book. Now, a lot of truth was not divulged.
Exactly. Which is the same thing that I said in the beginning, is that it was very superficially done, leaving white people in a very good light while making dings at, especially black women being overweight and the descriptive narrative for black women. It put us in a very bad light. But to what Gus was stating with the system and with everything else that's going on, yes, the white people put him in place because he was raised by white people. He came from a white mother. He would be more sympathetic to their cause, which is one of the reasons why we were saying about mating with white people, having children with white people, the divided loyalties that these children they have for white people, because it's very hard for a child, especially if it's a mother that is a white person, that nursed this child, was there for this child from day one. It's hard for them to pick a side and say, okay, well, you're talking all pro-black, and I'm going to jump on the black tee when I'm done with Whitey, and I hate Whitey and all. It's impossible. They're going to be, they're lying to themselves, and they're lying to you. They're too closely connected to this individual.
He talks about that in the book. He talks about that when he kept, when they were saying Whitey and all this stuff, the black nationalist, how he was thinking about his mother's smile. That is mentioned in the book.
How about when she butchered his brother's name? You know, white folks know how to pronounce Meshach and Shishak, but they can't pronounce simple, you know, just a simple name. You know, yeah.
And these tragic arrangements, because his sister Oma, she also was in a tragic arrangement, had a child with a white male. So it seemed that was something started with Barack Sr. with the tragic arrangements in the family, and it has trickled down into this generation as well. Because I was reading somewhere a few years ago where she was involved in a nasty custody battle with the father of the child. I believe he's either Canadian or British, that didn't want the child to leave to go back with her. So I don't know if she ever got that matter resolved.
I thought the grandfather that was involved in the tragic arrangement as well. Remember the pictures that were on the wall? So it would go back as far as him.
Yeah, the grandfather, he married, what is it, an Asian woman of Burmese or someone like that, that he married overseas when he was serving the British.
I thought she was white.
Yeah, I thought she was white.
I thought he married a woman of, she was Burmese, she was Asian, the woman that he married, they mentioned. But the woman that he brought back, the image that he brought back was a white woman when he was in England, but the wife that they said he married, she was Asian. She was somewhere in the Burma jungle where he was with the British outfit.
He
has like three or four wives.
I'm reading it right now. I studied the pictures for some time until I noticed one last picture on the wall. It was a vintage print, the kind that grace old Coca-Cola ads, of a white woman with thick dark hair and slightly dreamy eyes. I asked what the print was doing there, and Alma turned to Granny, who answered in Luo. She says that it is a picture of one of our grandfather's wives. He told people that he had married her in Burma when he was in the war.
Gus got that. He got that doggone. He got a bookmark on that one.
I highlighted, baby.
Okay. And then again, too, what I was thinking, because as much as he hated his son getting involved with a white woman when he sent all those nasty letters to Hawaii to split them up, I'm thinking to myself that back in those days, it was a status symbol to get pictures of white women and say they were your intimate. But maybe he could have faked the funk and just got some picture of some white woman and brought it home to show off to people that, hey, I was married to this woman when he was not.
Well, the reality is that back in those days, that generation of African leaders, they're all in tragic arrangements. That's the ones who went abroad to study, and then they come back, and then they become president, or they're higher-ups. The generation that's, I guess, the African baby boomers, for lack of a better word, they tend to be in tragic arrangements. It's kind of sad.
No, this in the 30s, when his grandfather was in the war, was a servant in the war. That's who I was speaking of.
Man, I kind of think about the World War II soldiers that was set up by white women, how he got out of that from being set up. Maybe, you know, because he wasn't an American.
I wanted to share, before the program wrapped up, I wanted to just throw in, I was thinking about from the previous book, The Bluest Eye, the scene where... I forget who it was, but it was a memory of somebody when they were younger. Oh, the father of the female. But when he was with another female, and they were having like a tender moment. You know, they were like, out somewhere in a field or something, and then they were like, you know, intimately. You know, they were like, you know, it was him and a female, and they were gonna,
they were, I don't know, they were just together, and then I think they were having sex, maybe. And then some white guys came through, some racists, and they were like, oh, don't stop now, you know, like, keep going, give us a show, you know? And then he, like, so he's, like, he basically was forced to rape her for the benefit of these guys, and then after it was done, then he, like, looked at her like she was a whore, you know? And I kind of feel like that's similar to how this is kind of like he's put on a show for people, and he doesn't realize that he's kind of blaming the victim, while without realizing that they're victims of white supremacy. I don't know, like, just some of the things he said, like, during that last speech he gave for John Kerry. There was a few moments where he said he was talking about shady deals and dark and all this stuff about money, I don't know. But it just, like, kind of laying on the language to where, and then he was saying, he didn't say anything good about Michelle. He said that the one female looked like a Latin goddess or a Latin countess. And then he's like, oh, yeah, Ama looked okay, too. He didn't say one word about Michelle. And
I was just going to ask that.
And his grandfather said, oh, she was a looker, right? And relating that with how his grandmother was having sentiments about black men, like that she was afraid. And I was feeling like the Oedipal complex. You know, like, where she was, like, wanted to kill the black man. She's, like, looking at the black man, like, oh, she was afraid of the black man. And then his grandfather was saying that his wife was a looker, which sounds innocent, but it's, you know, I mean, who do you really say that about? Like, oh, she's a looker, you know, I mean.
Yeah, but I was about to ask that. Did he say anything of how she looked when he first met her? I mean... On the scale, at least did he say it about the female on the when he got off the plane when he first went back?
He
lost his luggage.
She was kind of like she had the something about like his grandma. She related his wife to his grandma, you know. But like the only people that said anything good about her was his white, you know, family members, kind of like they were the only ones that would say anything good about his father. Like, they're the whole redeeming quality is white people, you know, like, and the black people are just there on standby just for window dressing. And white people, the problem is white people, you know, but I mean, it's just like, it's just kind of like a show, like, just like a bunch of black people just dancing around, like, for the benefit of white people. That's, I mean, you know.
Which is why I mentioned earlier that, and said that with him, he was raised with white people. That's the yardstick that he has to use to measure everyone else. That's why he referred to Michelle Manson's grandmother, who's also from the Midwest, Kansas, and those qualities that the grandmother had. He has no other black female within which to make any kind of comparative analysis besides a sister that he met maybe, what, for a couple of weeks in the years of his adult life. So he really don't have any black female good comparative personnel to make comparisons to.
Well, he lived in Southeast Asia for a little while in Malaysia, so I'm sure he ran into plenty of females over there that was
not white.
Say again?
Yeah, but he was very young.
He was there as a young child. I believe he came back when he was about 10 years old. He came back from Southeast Asia. But he was not exposed to black female, adult black female in positive role image for him to say, okay, this is someone I went to school with, I went to college with. Look how he described the women as Occidental. They're always big, heavy-set women on Jemima-type characters. He didn't have that daily interaction on a regular like we do with our aunts, cousins, and so on to say that we can make those comparisons with females. He didn't have that. So black women have been reduced to this cartoonish type character. That's what we've been reduced to.
We have done our overtime the whole nine. Ruth Fine, she wrote in. She's in addition to what you all have just pointed out about the representation of black females, or I guess black people in general, she was saying the same thing. She felt that black males also have are not portrayed very well, that they are just kind of mistake-prone, sex-obsessed, abusive, morons, that the black men, nobody, black people in general do not come out looking very well.
Always trying to get over. Put that in there.
Yes, trying to get over. Trying to get over scheming that no black people in general don't come out looking very well in the book. I was going to point out really quickly, this is in the epilogue, where Toot, the white grandmother, she references Michelle Obama as a very sensible girl. And then President Obama, in his own speech at the DNC, he references himself as a skinny kid, not men and women, boys and girls. Boys and girls, consistent pattern. Also, the point where they were talking about the papers for the grandfather, Barack Obama's grandfather, black grandfather, it reminded me of all of the white people clamoring for his birth certificate and his high school record. Show us your papers, nigger. Very consistent pattern and just standard trifling racist behavior. Got to have those slave papers. We will be back tomorrow. I will say for listeners, I never had that emotional attachment to President Obama. I think some people said they were caught up at first. Even today, I think some folks said that they at first, felt like, hey, this is not a white male. He's trying to do right, blah, blah, blah. I never really had any of that. If I did, and then when I became to get more informed about racism and white supremacy, I'd probably be very upset hearing that speech, the one at the DNC, and just becoming less confused. I'd probably be very angry that I fell for that just because I don't like a lot of rhetoric and foolishness, and that the DNC speech, even the fact that they included that in the audiobook, like with all the stuff that you heard that they omitted that I had to read to add to it, the fact that they left all that out to include this, which was not even in the book, 9 years later, to include that speech from the DNC, I think says a lot about what they wanted to accomplish with the audiobook. Again, I have a hard time listening to a lot of rhetoric and foolishness, and it just felt dripping with artificialness with that speech at the DNC. Again, something I could see why white people would get behind that easily. Anywho, we'll be back tomorrow. Compensatory call-in. Thoroughly enjoyed the feedback. I hope it was a constructive investment of your time hearing the audiobook Dreams from My Father. As I said, I think you could probably learn quite a bit about the system of white supremacy. I think you would have to have some information about the system before reading the book. But I think if you had that, you can pick out quite a bit from the book. We will be back tomorrow evening, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Compensatory call-in. World AIDS Day will be so grand. We will make sure to get a sound clip. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, she just had a 45-minute press conference talking about all the wonderful, cool drugs that are going to be dumping on the continent of Africa and probably black people in the neighborhood near you. World AIDS Day tomorrow. Invest if the program is constructive. You can visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal link is in the top right corner. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can share with other non-white people, post it on your Facebook, Twitter. If you have websites or social media sites, let non-white people know about the broadcast if you think it would be constructive. I would say keep in mind, regardless of what you think, how you feel about President Obama, the thing that is most important to keep in mind, he would not be in the White House if the most powerful white people did not want him to be there. That is the most important thing to keep in mind. Thank you all for tuning in. Does anybody want to do the prayer? Wrap us up.
And I guess that's me.
Cool in the game. Thanks for tuning in. S-Dot, take us away.
Creator, we are honored and humbled by another opportunity to come together as your confused sons and daughters to gain more clarity about the global system of racism, white supremacy. We thank you for all the tools and resources that you put forth to help us in our confusion to overcome this illusion of racism, white supremacy. We thank you for all of those who are committed to solving this problem. And we ask that you continue to give us strength and integrity as we go forth to replace the global system of racism, white supremacy with justice immediately. Ashe.
Ashe. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thank you all for tuning in.
Damn you, Obama.